Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. You know, I was trying at the last minute here to confirm something I'd heard, I don't know how long ago, maybe years ago, the threshold of revolution is a 40% tax rate. In other words, if you take 40% of the average person's income for taxes, you've got a revolution. I know our country, back at our founding, went through a revolution over a 2% tax. It'd be kind of nice to have that spirit today. But the point is that when things cost too much, the people revolt. You look around the world. You look around at various places. What is the one thing that brings people out into the streets? It's the cost of living, you know, especially when it's government imposed. And you look at any socialist country, communist country, you know, when things get bad, which they always do, because socialists and communists think they can run everything, and they simply can't. You know, they've proven time and time again that the greater the central planning and the greater the central control, the worse things are for everybody, and the better they are for a small minority on the top. And so everybody wants to be that small minority on the top, which is where you get your political assassinations and all the other crazy things that happen around the world. But the point is that I remember revolts in France and revolts in England and different places throughout time, various countries, Venezuela. You know, as countries become socialist and communist, there's a point at which everything gets too expensive and, you know, the people revolt. Well, the question is, when's that going to happen here? Because things are getting so expensive so quickly, and everybody knows it's for no reason. Everybody knows it's Brandon and the insurrection, the leftists. Everybody knows that the price of gasoline should be about $1.85 a gallon. Anything more than $1.85 a gallon is exploitation. You know, because we know we have enough oil here for several hundred years. You know, long past, you know, a few generations down the line's lifetime. We know we can produce it cheaply. We know that we can export all kinds of energy. We know that the earth makes oil, that CO2 is good for the environment, that the Western states' land is actually state land and not federal land. We know all these things. We know that we can walk out of this tomorrow or today by simply putting in a lawful administration in the White House. But the fact that the government that stole the White House has stolen our energy, stolen our future, stolen 2 years of our life through bogus COVID policies and stolen pretty much everything they can. This is a government of thieves. Sooner or later, the people are going to revolt. Now, people are, you know, Americans generally don't want to get out in the streets. They don't want to do these kind of course, they're leftists, you know, protesting for what they call, you know, to keep abortion safe. There's a contradiction if ever there was one, keeping abortion safe. Of course, my question is for who? You know, but and I don't mean to make light of that, but think about it. At some point, you know, the folks, you know, like I said, we had the gas lines in the 70s. I remember that. I was a teenager, and I'm looking around going, oh, gee, when I get to drive, look what I get to look forward to, gas lines, okay? So that was Jimmy Carter's solution, rationing, fueling up every other day. In fact, I've got an article here from the New York Post written a couple of days ago on rationing. That's not what I think the problem is. I think the problem is, a story a friend of mine alerted me to yesterday is that the gas stations in Washington State have reset to accommodate a $10 a gallon price. And I went, oh, no, that's not good. That is a forebearer. That is the canary in the coal mine, folks. OK, the canary just died. You know, if they're gearing up for $10 a gallon fuel, you know, not only is the canary dead, it's been, you know, shoved out of the coal mine. It's gone. You know, like all the canaries are dead. I mean, the warning signs are there that we are poised for a revolution. And I mean a cost of living revolution. I don't mean a political revolution. Every bit as much as I think some of the great, you know, Shays Rebellion, Whiskey Rebellion, things like that. It's not a revolt. I think that's probably a better term for it because people are going to be revolting. They're going to be revolting against the illegal government, the price of fuel, the price of everything. I mean, people are already changing their life around. You know, all the vacations that have been canceled, you know, which reflects on everything. There's a lot of people who are dependent on vacations. There's a lot of beach towns in this country. You know, there's a lot of folks that run diners and restaurants and retail places. In fact, there's a lot of local gas stations run by families all over the country. You know, they're all hurting because they know their profit, you know, is not that much above the price. So they make a – I've forgotten what the formula is, but, you know, it's not – the price doesn't matter so much. They just, you know – raise it at, what, a few cents a gallon or whatever it is, however many cents a gallon above, maybe in a dollar or two above. I'm not sure. Yeah, no, it wouldn't be that much. Anyway, but the profit margin of a gas station is not that great. But they make money off it, obviously. I mean, that's, you know, the fuel company brings it in and they pump it out and they take a little bit. I mean, that's how you get retail gasoline. Nothing wrong with that. But the problem is, it's not the families that are causing the problem. It's Brandon and the leftists. And the theory is that they want to make gasoline so expensive that we are forced into something that they want for us. Well, that's social engineering. So what we're really going to be revolting against is a stupid ideology based on misinformation. You want to talk about disinformation? You know, Disinformation Bureau, I'm kind of sorry that it's going away a little bit, because I think it's going to be really useful, because obviously everything put out by the Brandon insurrection is disinformation. So the fact that they have a Disinformation Bureau is perfect for them, because that's what they're going to be doing. You know, we might as well just put it out there and just call it, you know, from here's the latest from the Disinformation Bureau is your latest disinformation. Well, the disinformation that this problem is caused by Putin. Oh, give me a break. I'm not even going to address that. That is too stupid for words. All right. But we've got a problem. We've got a very serious problem. And at some point, this is going to get crazy. You know, you're going to start to get the stealing of gasoline. And I mean, why do you think we have locking gas caps? America didn't have locking gas caps until the 70s. Why? Because nobody stole gasoline. It was 25 cents a gallon. Now, granted, today that would be more like, I don't know, $1.85. Let's find out. I'm going to do my inflation calculator. We'll take a break. But the point is, in the 1970s, when I arrived in the United States, gas was 25 cents a gallon. And people, you know, I mean, they'd give the gas person, back in those days, you actually had people pump your gas, right? And they clean your windows and they pump your gas. And it was great. And see, you know, friends of mine, when I was a teenager, we actually went out, you know, with the older kids, you know, the band kids usually. And they'd, you know, give $2 to the gas guy to pump, to fill it, fill her up. Here's $2. I'm like, oh, that's kind of interesting. All right, that's not a big deal. Yeah, think about the energy you get from a gallon of gas. A gallon of gas can power a multi-ton vehicle, you know, anywhere from 30 to 50 miles. That's pretty amazing. So gasoline itself is a huge source of energy. It's amazingly powerful. The breaking of those octane chains, that's what octane is. It's a carbon chain. You guys ever take organic chemistry? I was forced into that in college. Oh, my God, the most boring subject in the world. Anyway, but maybe it was the most boring professor in the world, which is pretty high honor. It's not easy to get because so many of them are so boring. Anyway, point being, that's an organic chemical. It's a hydrocarbon. It's made in the earth, and they're charging us. You know, it's all artificial. What's happening now is as artificial as the COVID, quote, pandemic. There was no pandemic. We had the cure all along, and we knew, and they knew it. You know, so the fact that COVID was basically a flu bug that was 99.95% ineffective, really, you know, on the entire population of the United States. I did the show yesterday that the only pandemic was government power. Well, they're still under that. You know, they've moved on from COVID to energy. And they're thinking, hey, well, we got this far. Let's keep going. Now, they know that their polls are horrible. They know that everybody hates them. They don't care, which means they've already planned on stealing the midterms. You know, so what's the point of having the midterms? If the Democrats are so – they're doing everything they know, you know, that we hate. They're doing it anyway. Which means they obviously know they're going to be cheating enough in the midterms to change the result, or they know that even if the Republicans win, they're going to put McCarthy in charge of the House and McConnell in charge of the Senate, which is effectively, you know, having it run by Democrats still. So that's probably – so one of those two – and I'm not sure the answer. I don't know. In fact, even somebody as well-connected and you know, former Trump administration person as Josh Whitehouse, who was on Wednesday, doesn't know. You know, he doesn't know why the Republicans are behaving as they're behaving. But the gelding old party, you know, the folks that actually put Brandon in office, in other words, Mike Pence, the traitor, followed closely by the rest of the geldings, especially Mitch McConnell, put Brandon there by refusing to look at the lawful Trump electors and instead took the fraudulent Brandon ones from states where they obviously was vote fraud. So that's why we have the problems we have. This is a vote fraud problem. And so these insurrectionists have gotten in power, blaming everybody else for insurrection, which is what they're doing. But my question to you, and feel free to call me, 215-383-3832. In fact, Fridays, we're going to be 6 o'clock, maybe 6:30. I haven't decided what to do with Fridays. I really like the idea of going to 7 o'clock. I'll still probably get up at the ridiculous hour of 4, but it'll give me an extra hour to kind of sit around and prep and think and, you know, do some stuff. Because I think most people do better in the morning. But if you're going to get up in the morning before my show, you got to get up pretty early. And so that would give me a chance to sort of reflect on these. And I think next week I'm going to take a look at the thresholds of revolution. At what point did countries, you know, break down? So here's what I'm predicting. I'm predicting that because this is a government problem, This is 100% a government problem, because we know we have the fracking. We know we have the production capability. We know we have the pipeline. We just have to open it. You know, I think it's almost built. We know we have the infrastructure. We know we have the transportation. We know we have the truckers. We'll probably need more truckers. You know, we know we are able to use oil and turn it into gasoline and other petroleum products and have the price be about $1.85 a gallon. We know that. Okay, we know that because it happened under Trump. Now, the fact that people are reporting, you know, the gas price in Trump's last year, or they're reporting it a year ago or something, that's all BS. That's to cover up the truth. That's to cover up the fact that the price was $1.85 a gallon. And I keep saying it over and over again until everybody knows deep in their hearts that the price of gasoline, you know, was and should still be about $1.85 a gallon. Yeah, okay. Now the world oil price. But Greg, I'll do a Rush Limbaugh. Nobody talks about him anymore, and they should. Anyway, so Rush used to say, but Rush, you know, what about? Well, I'm going to give you a but Greg. The price of oil is $1, you know, it was $108 or $115 a barrel. Well, okay, well, why is that? Well, it's because we're not producing oil. If we were producing oil at, you know, $40 a barrel, do you think the world price of oil would be $115 a barrel? No. It'd be more like $60 a barrel. Why? Because they'd be buying our oil, and that would bring the price down. You know, who's going to buy Saudi oil at $115 a barrel when they can buy American oil at $40 a barrel? That's just supply and demand, okay? So you want to lower the world price of oil, and it's not Putin. I think I just blew up my microphone there. I'm going to speak to the side. It's not Putin. Oh, it's too strong. Popping pee. That's a microphone. That's a radio thing. Anyway, so it's not Putin that's doing this. It's Brandon. Brandon's in South Korea right now. No, he's not going to walk across the border and go talk to Kim Jong. Ugh. I think I made a mistake. It's Kim Jong-un is the new one. Kim Jong-il is his father. I misspoke, I think, yesterday, the day before, talking about this. But he's in the funny thing is that Brandon, you know, using our gasoline, you know, to fly to South Korea, is congratulating the South Koreans on their manufacturing and their job creation. It doesn't get more ironic, you know. And, of course, even Fox News hasn't pointed out that little tidbit of hypocrisy. But that's what's going on. And it's congratulating the fact that Samsung is going to build a factory here so that foreign chips can be produced in the United States rather than creating a tax structure and an environment, a business-friendly environment, so that an American company can build things and sell them to South Korea. I mean, that's what should happen. But Brandon doesn't see it that way. He's just happily surrounded by his little Asian people, and he's happy. He's happy being seen with minorities, except that in Korea, he's the minority. But he doesn't see it that way because he's an arrogant white guy, right? He's a racist. So he surrounds himself with little Asian people. I mean, that's what it looks like. He's the tallest guy in the room. And not that there aren't tall Koreans. Trust me, if you see the army, there's a lot of tall Koreans, okay? Not an issue. But it is for Brandon, so he surrounds himself with short Asians. it's a Brandon supremacy thing. I mean, just call me, you know, funny. And they're all wearing masks, too. I don't know if they wear masks in South Korea or not. But the point is, he took our gasoline to fly to South Korea for no reason. I bet his popularity goes up. You know, there was a joke routine that I forgot where it was, on some comedy show. Mr. President, your poll ratings were great when you were in Paris. They were great where you were in Rio de Janeiro. They were great when you were in Sydney, Australia. What about here in the United States? No, they kind of suck there. So it's time to plan another trip. So this is what presidents do. They create wars and they travel because they're more popular when there's some other country, you know, abusing them as opposed to abusing us. So that's the problem. So Brandon's there. The other thing, is the baby formula thing. Now, the baby formula thing is quite fascinating because we did a show yesterday, and the subject came up of homemade baby formula. You know, I mean, this is what Americans did for generations. Okay, they didn't rely on Abbott Labs in the 1800s to make their baby formula when breast milk was either not available, not appropriate, or not good for the kid. So I don't know when you know, moms and dads first, you know, sat in the kitchen and concocted baby formula at night. But I'll tell you, you know, it was long before the cans on the supermarket shelves. And so I think it was, let's see, pull up the, no, it's on Facebook. Anyway, point being, in the various, you know, syrups and things and various vitamins and minerals and different stuff you put in there, right? And so you can make, you know, homemade baby formula. Well, of course, as soon as they post that, you know, Facebook immediately had a warning. Misinformation. Some people might find this misleading. Don't use your own remedies. You know, wait till the government puts the government approved, government, you know, regulated, government stolen baby formula back on the shelves. You stupid people. Why would you think for yourself? You know, and it's like hydroxychloroquine all over again. And so the fact that Facebook and big tech banned, you know, talking about hydroxychloroquine, of course, didn't stop us here at Action Radio. I didn't care. You know, now they're banning the talk of homemade baby formula. Well, we're going to keep talking about it. You know, I've already made the decision. In fact, I posted this last night on on my Facebook page. And I should probably do it on the – we have a public one too, the Action Radio Group. So you want to know the news of Action Radio, that's where you go, the Action Radio Group. That's where you can also find the homemade baby formula. Okay, so that's there too. So we're here to serve you in every way possible, politics, baby formula, you name it. We've got a solution for you. Anyway, so we post this, and of course the warning label comes on. And it's really quite fascinating. But that was proof to me that this is – I mean, I knew it was artificial, but that was just more confirmation. The fact that big tech would say that a homemade baby formula that probably has worked for, I don't know, hundreds, thousands of years. I don't know. How long have moms needed, you know, extra help there? I don't know. Probably since they've been moms. It's a long time, all right? You know, I'm sure a lot of kids died for lack of baby formula, you know, back in the 17, 16, 15, 1400s. I mean, however far back you want to go, you know, for lack of knowledge of homemade baby formula. Okay, so somewhere along the line, some bright mom and dad got together and said, well, we got a problem here. We need extra for Junior. We need a little supplement here. And so most Americans were farmers, you know, at one point. So, you know, using cow's milk plus other stuff would not have been a problem. Okay, and so there you go. You know, I mean, the answer is usually your own personal ingenuity. People, the cult of the expert has taken away the ability of Americans to think for themselves and to trust their own judgment. Okay, this is a terrible curse, you know, and even if you make a mistake, okay, you make a mistake, you do your best, you're going to learn, you're going to do better next time. But if you never try, you're never going to make the mistakes that are going to lead you to the proper conclusions, you know, and if you don't trust your own judgment, you can ask other folks, you can go to different sources, you can do that kind of stuff. But at some point, you have to make a decision, okay? And so your decision is, you know, let your kids starve or make homemade baby formula. That's a no-brainer for me. But if you're one of these conditioned people that think, oh, no, I have to rely on experts. I need experts. I need a biologist to tell me if I'm a man or a woman. I mean, what kind of absurdity is that? I have to have an expert tell me pronouns to use with which people so I don't offend them. Screw that. He, she, they, you know, he and she are singular. They is plural. I mean, this is English. This is just basic English, okay? Anyway, let me get you some stories here. We've got Shirley Watchful. We've got Jim Dykes. We've got Derek Park. Chappie's at a shooting match. And so he'll be back at some point. We're gonna with Chappie's report, we're gonna sort of make it a little more off schedule. And so as he has guests, as he has things to talk about, we're gonna bring in Chappie. So I'm probably gonna do with that third hour, which I'm hoping to move to between 9 and 10 a.m. But if it's 8 to 9 a.m., the last hour of the day, I want to make that a guest host hour. Okay. So if you ever wanted to host an hour of Action Radio, message me, get me on Facebook, call the show, email me, greg@writeyourlaws.com. That's our public email. And let me know. And I firmly believe, I mean, this show is all about opportunity. Opportunity for everyone. Only because for most of my life, I was told of opportunities I couldn't have. Okay. Oh, I do have my Facebook window open. So let me give you the baby formula that Facebook doesn't want you to have. And so let's see here, the Action Radio Group. Go to the Action Radio Group. It's on Facebook, and this is public. I mean, my Facebook page is friends only out of necessity because too many people on the left who were, I thought, friends were reporting me to Facebook. You know, they'd make some horrendous lie about me, right? And then I defend myself, which is kind of what I do. And then they'd complain to Facebook I was bullying, and then Facebook would shut me down, even though they started it. It was like, yeah, you know how that works. Okay, so here's the post. Natural baby formula recipe. 1 teaspoon organic olive oil, 1 teaspoon organic coconut oil. And we know Chancy Terry, our wine, weed, and wellness person, is big on coconut oil. So we'll talk about that. 1 teaspoon organic brown rice syrup, 1/8 teaspoon blackstrap molasses. There you go. Well, I might skip the brown rice and go right to the molasses. That's pretty good stuff. So the minerals, too. Liquid multivitamin dosage according to directions, 1 teaspoon powdered goat milk formula, 1/4 teaspoon infant probiotic. Okay, this only goes in one bottle a day. Okay, and I got it right here, filled bottle. I can't throw that stupid Facebook message, missing context. What context am I missing? Facebook. What context am I missing? Here, this is baby formula for people that can't buy it in the stores. And maybe it's better to make it on your own anyway. Did you ever think of that? Maybe the store stuff, in fact, I think this is probably the case. The store stuff is worse for your baby than the stuff you could make yourself. Yeah, especially, look at all the good stuff here. Olive oil, coconut oil, brown rice syrup, molasses, you know, vitamins, minerals, and all kinds. What's the problem? What could possibly be dangerous that Facebook would have a warning for something that's that good? That's insane. All right, let me take my Facebook window. I don't want to my computer. That's the thing when you broadcast on Blog Talk or any of these things. The more windows you have open, the more problems you can have. But just by the nature of the fact that this is a show based on news, a lot of times I have to have a lot of windows open. All right, so I got the story last night that stations were preparing for double-digit gallon gas. And the first report I have is from M. Dowling from the website Independent Sentinel, my new favorite website. And so M. Dowling I've written to, and I think it's Maureen Dowling. Hopefully we'll get her on the show at some point because she's ballsy. She writes really direct articles. But Washington's interesting. Now, as soon as I heard Washington State was the place where they raised the $10 gasoline, I immediately remembered that it was Washington State where COVID came in the nursing homes. So Washington State was the first people to kill off their seniors with COVID, you know, as a weapon, what do they call it? What's old age aside? There's a word for it. Was it gerontologist aside or something, whatever the word is. The killing of old people. Somebody look it up for me. Right? So I need a producer again. And so that's what's happening up in Washington. So Washington is my canary in the coal mine once again. Okay, the canary died again. Canary died when I read the report that gas might go to $10 or even $15 a gallon. Okay, at that point I realized that we are set for a revolution, and I believe that or a revolt, and I believe that the country's not going to stand for $10 a gallon gasoline. They're just not. Too much of our energy, too much of our lives, too much of our cost of living is dependent on plentiful and low-cost energy. And the thing is, we have plentiful and low-cost energy. You know, so this is an ideological war. We're fighting an ideological war with people that stole our government and insist on us using electricity, you know, for everything. Well, guess where electricity comes from? The very things that they banned. Coal, oil, natural gas, uranium. You know, all the things that they don't want for energy to make the energy that they do want, they're cutting the supply of the things that we want. And we proved yesterday that the burning of fuel, of petroleum, actually is the continuation of the carbon cycle. It's recycling. We proved this yesterday that the carbon that is in the air and carbon dioxide goes into plants, and the plants, you know, that become oil, and the oil that becomes gasoline, and the gasoline that gets burned in your tank releases, guess what? Carbon dioxide. That's what they all say, the greenhouse warming people, right? So carbon dioxide goes back into the air where it came from. It's the ultimate recycling. So the burning of fuel in your SUV is actually continuing the carbon cycle. What's the problem here? It couldn't be greener. There's nothing greener than oil. Oil is part of the earth. Oil is made by the earth. Okay? Not these crazy things that these leftists want to do, these big turbines that are killing the birds using all kinds of mine chemical, mine minerals and things like that that are killing kids in Africa that are trying to get the lithium. Okay? Oil's there. The earth makes it. The earth replenishes it. Why do you think the oil fields fill up after they've been drilled? You think it's an accident? No! The earth makes oil. Okay? So as we get ready for a revolution, my co-host is here. Good. Okay. So let's bring on Pianki. And I'll ask him the same question I've been asking everybody. At what price are we going to have a gas revolt? Are people going to be standing outside the doors of every congressional office and Senate office in the country and screaming and yelling, saying, gas price down? Pianki, what do you think? Good morning, sir.
Well, good morning, Greg. By the time I get $10 and within a few dollars of that, all hell would have broke loose. Mm-hmm. But I also want to say, I remember as a little baby drinking K-Roll syrup, mm-hmm. based formula that my yep. mom made. Yep. And it was good, man. It was really, really good.
Yeah, I just read the ingredients of the formula I post.
And I'm not reformed. Yeah. You know, the thing that gets me is how they jumped up, how you have the CDC and other agencies jump out. And all supporters of these agents jump out and say, oh, if you do this, it's very dangerous. You're going to poison your baby.
With what, corn syrup? With legal products?
With the homemade formulas.
Well,
homemade formulas.
What do you think? Well, I think Americans have surrendered their own judgment. They refuse to, they don't feel competent to make a decision anymore. They're so scared by the cult of the expert that they think unless it's officially approved, it's not real. And that's nonsense. I mean, look at the ingredients. What was it? Olive oil, molasses, you know, you had K-Roll syrup, you know, different things like that, some goat's milk powder, some vitamins, minerals, and milk. And that's baby formula. I could probably make baby formula now, and I don't have a baby. So, you know, I mean, I've got the recipe right there on Facebook in the Action Radio group. And there's nothing in that what molasses is dangerous? Give me a break. Well, obviously too much is. You don't feed your kid molasses, you know, exclusively. But molasses is full of minerals. It's one of the most mineral-rich, products that we have. People don't know that. That's what, you know, Guinness is one of the richest sources of iron.
Blackstrap molasses.
Blackstrap molasses, exactly. Yeah, but women in Ireland are prescribed mm-hmm. Guinness when they're pregnant because it replaces their iron. Well, you can't have alcohol if you're pregnant. Okay, well, tell that to the Irish women. But it's, what's that?
How did they get on this baby formula stuff anyway? Did you got Joe Brandon, who's wanting to import it from other countries, other than manufacturers in other countries who've been trying to get into the American market. Wouldn't it be something that the mother, of course, we don't have as many as we used to, but from here forth on, they make their own baby formula out of the recipes that's floating around that people are digging up out of the foot lockers at the foot of their beds that grandmother left.
Yep. Well, that's just going to happen. Because the independent people, the mavericks, the you know, are going to survive. It's like we're the same people. The people that make baby formula are the same people that have refused the COVID jab because they know it causes, you know, spike proteins and heart attacks, brain damage, kidney failure, and everything else. So the same people that are independent enough to have not taken the jab are the folks that are going to make their own baby formula and go, this is good stuff. There's nothing here that's unnatural. It's a perfectly natural product. That can be bad for the baby. I mean, get real. And so you're going to see you're going to see a split in this country. You're going to see a split in this country between mavericks and cowards. And the cowards are the ones that are taking the jab. The cowards are the ones who are dying. You know, unfortunately, in a war, I think this is why governments love wars, because they take all the brave people and they get killed. And who's left behind to rebuild the country? The cowards. You know, the ones that didn't go. You know, obviously there are people who are 4F and classified that they can't fight. I understand that. I'm not making fun of people that, you know, aren't in physical shape to fight. But generally, the bravest people are the ones that go fight the battles. And governments can systematically do that. Look at World War I. You know, that millions of young men were killed. And who was left to rebuild the country? You know, the cowards, you know, the people that wouldn't fight. And actually, there's a good chance that I wouldn't fight, but not because I was a coward, but because I knew better. I'm not going to go sit in a trench, run into barbed wire and get gunned to death for some aristocrat or monarch. That's just stupid. But at some point, this country's going to revolt. I think it's going to be about $7.50 a gallon. I'm just going to make an arbitrary figure that if gasoline gets over $7 a gallon, you know, you're going to start to see some serious protests and it's going to get worse. And every dollar that it goes up, it's going to get worse and worse and worse as people get more desperate. Gas stealing is going to become huge. Gas tank hijacking. You know about carjacking? Pretty soon you're going to have gas station hijacking. People are going to put a gun to the head of the people in the gas stations and they're going to pump their gas and they're going to drive away. And they're going to have to do it fast because, of course, there'll be police and all that kind of stuff. But we are headed for a revolt, like the whiskey revolt and some of the other revolts. That's what I predict. What do you think? I know you're there. Unmute. Actually, I got Shirley on the line.
If you come in and you still...
There you go.
If you come in, you steal up to 25 gallons of gas. Anybody that's still right shy of 25 gallons of gas, the police can't bother.
Is that one of those liberal DA things or something, or what?
That's going to be one of those like the Walgreens things where you run in there and have a calculator, $945, so just walk right on out. They can't bother you.
Well, that's fascinating. Well, you notice they're taking away the things that are valuable, food, you know, energy, all the things that, you know, and they're nationalized, and healthcare. And COVID nationalized healthcare. We'll talk about the WHO treaty on Monday. You know, the WHO's greatest hit is going to be on you. That's going to be the title of the show. I'll give you a little preview. You know, the WHO being the World Health Organization. And so this is what's coming. You know, and they're trying to nationalize, like I said, they nationalize energy, nationalize food, nationalize everything, centrally plan everything, and tell you that you're going to be happy. Well, I don't think so. This is a preview of what nationalization and communism looks like. I don't want any part of it. Of course, I never did. Anyway,
well,
let me get you a comment.
Wouldn't
it
be something that states ban any foreign imported baby formula? If states were... taking back this federal land and states have their own actors that's drilling and processing and refining oil into gasoline where they can put the oil on they can sell the oil on the national supply pipes and keep the profits for the state itself. Nothing goes to the federal government.
That'd be great. You know, intrastate commerce. In other words, if it's produced in a state, well, of course, it'll be interesting to see what Congress tries to regulate. But the states would say, you know, basically, F you. I mean, that's what has to happen. The states need to start taking their power back. And this goes for so many different areas. You know, the state should be, in fact, I put this on Facebook last night. I'm pretty sure that if the government was actually interested in the people, they would have published homemade baby formula. They would say, here, this works. Try this. You know, I mean, if the government was actually interested in the people, that's what they would have done. They would have published baby formula. They would have said, this is wonderful. Do it. I'm surprised Trump didn't do it. I mean, this is a perfect opportunity for him and for the Geldings to say, look, go ahead, make your own baby formula. Anyway, let's talk to Shirley. I'm curious what she thinks of this, and we'll get into DC guns and women, and we'll be right back. Let me try again. I think I misdid the title. I'll look it up. Anyway, here we go. When one is faced with a crisis, you find your true character. How you react to such an emergency can determine the rest of your life. Two paths present themselves for you to choose. One leads to tragedy. The other leads to becoming a new person. Shirley Wattrall, a survivor of a dangerously abusive relationship, is that new person. She is the author of Heels to Holster. She is a firearms instructor, motivational speaker, women's empowerment advocate, and a reporter for Action Radio. So now, here is the DC Project, Women and Guns, with Shirley Wattrall. Well, at least I got it right when I made the theme. Sorry about that, Shirley. This is what happens when I improvise. Ah, boy. Yeah. So, do you want to weigh in on the baby formula, Brandon in Korea, or any of the other stupid things, or the price of gas that you think is going to cause a revolt in this country? And then get going on your report. Feel free. Just jump right in.
Well, wow. That's a whole lot in just like 10 seconds.
No, it's actually half an hour. It took a little more to develop than that. But yeah.
But the recap was like a 10-second recap.
That was the recap, exactly. And that's how you get on the national news. They just give you the recap. They wouldn't give you the actual story. That's what we do here.
Yeah, you can make up your own story. Just take the recap and run with it. But when you were talking, I just caught a couple minutes of you talking about gas prices. Mm-hmm. When was it that people were siphoning out gas from the tanks? And then that's when they started putting locks on their gas tanks?
Yeah, that's exactly the point I made. Yeah, it was in the 70s.
When was that? 70s?
Well, the price of gas went from 25 cents to a dollar a gallon, which at the time was horrendous. We thought that was horrible. How can gas get about? We could tolerate 30 cents a gallon, but anything more. And then it went to 50 cents, and then it was a dollar. When gas hit a dollar, we said, oh, no, it's going to be terrible when gasoline hits a dollar a gallon. Of course, that today would be about $2 a gallon. You know, so the price of gas at $1.85, which is what it should be, which is what it was under Trump, was actually a little bit below the price back in the 70s when it hit a dollar a gallon, simply because of inflation. But I think about somewhere around $7.50, you know, nationwide. We're at $4.50 now. So about, if it goes up another $3, I think we're very going to be likely to have some kind of revolt. Well, and the problem is that Washington State, the same place that killed the seniors first with COVID in the nursing homes before New York decided to try it, that's where they've already redone their gas stations. 76 Oil Company, part of the original Standard Oil of New Jersey, which became ExxonMobil, Chevron, Gulf, Texaco, Sunoco, all those companies, when Standard Oil was broken up. They're changing their gas stations. They're changing their pumps to accommodate $10 a gallon gas. Now, why would they do that? Why would they do that unless they knew? Someone told them. This,
yeah.
You know, so is this where $10? And I'm thinking, you go to $10 a gallon, people aren't going to wait for the midterms. they're going to be revolting in the streets, you know, at around $7.50. That's my guess. Probably about $7.50. People are like, that's it. No more. We're done.
I can see. I mean, it's affecting us here in Naples, as far as, you know, people used to, because they couldn't afford to live here in town, so they'd mm-hmm. be driving in from other towns, and they can't afford that. They're all moving up north, so employment is going down. We're having problems finding employees for the restaurants, and mm-hmm. I hear teachers are moving north too, because of rent and gas prices. So, mm-hmm. yeah, it's. We need to address that. And the baby formula thing, that just irritates me that we're not taking care of the Americans and the parents. I can't imagine what it would be like for a parent not to be able to find baby formula.
Well, we published a homemade baby formula. You know, we've already.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that published somewhere. I don't know where it was, but I saw that come up also. But it's just the fact that Americans aren't put first, just like veterans aren't put first anymore, is just unbelievable as to where their country's going. But anyway.
Social engineering by Marxist ideology. And the Marxists aren't paying for the gas lane. They're using public gas. They're using, you know, Brandon's not paying for his gas tank for Air Force One. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah,
anyway,
true.
Yeah. So what's going on in D.C. Project of Women and Guns? What's happening?
So what we're going to start with is it's going to be the regular format. Like I talked about, I do a Teal for 2A Tuesday,
uh-huh.
which is a story of how a firearm was used to save a life. So I'm going to start by going over that article, and we can discuss that and see where that goes. And then
okay.
also one of our advisory board members testified at a subcommittee hearing meeting, and that was against the Jackson Elias Domestic Violence Survivor Protection Act hearing. Wow. But, okay, so let's get started with the story. This happened. It takes place in Norristown, Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
A man shot and killed two armed teenagers who tried to rob him in Norristown, Pennsylvania. He was walking to his car shortly before p.m. Friday along the 300 block of Warren Street when two 17-year-old boys approached him. The teens then tried to rob the man, pulled a gun on him, leading to a struggle. The man then pulled out his own legally registered gun and opened fire, according to the police. One teen was shot 5 times, while the second teen was shot once in the torso and once in the finger. The man then rendered aid to the teens and called 911. Both teens died from their injuries. Police have not revealed their identities, but said both were from Norristown. The man was questioned by police, then released. He has not been charged, though officials say that there's still an ongoing investigation into the incident. You know, it's really tragic.
Go ahead. Yeah.
The 17-year-olds are out there robbing people. Not only just robbing them, but they are armed robbers. Mm-hmm. And it's
and
tragic.
Thinking that's okay. And they think that's okay.
Yeah. And there's got to be, I think we got to get back to, there's got to be consequences to your actions. I think that's gotten blurred along the way. But it's tragic that those two young boys had to lose their life. But they were trying to, they were committing a crime, and they were trying to take the man's life.
You know, the tragedy, it'd be if the man lost his life. That would be the tragedy. You know, and as much it is a horrendous thing when anybody loses their life, especially that young, the problem is they caused their own life. They basically, you know, in a way, took their own lives by taking the actions that they took. You know, if you put somebody else's
exactly.
life in jeopardy, yeah, you put someone else's life in jeopardy, you forfeit your own. You know, and they have to know that. But, you know, the more people that are carrying, the more people that defend themselves, the more times these stories are known, you know, the message gets out. Sooner or later, it's going to have an effect that people, you know, are going to literally take the law into their own hands. And people hate that expression. But this is what the law is in our hands. We have to defend it. And we have the right under law to defend ourselves. So we literally take the law into our hands when we take the responsibility for defending ourselves in our own hands. Pianki, go ahead.
Yeah, what is a greater tragedy is that the news didn't report how this citizen, being armed, saved his own life. Mm-hmm. And if you could reflect that to the Brooklyn shooting, what if more people in the mall had been legally carrying weapons?
Oh, up in Buffalo? Or where are you talking
yes,
about?
Yes, in Buffalo. Did I say
yeah.
Brooklyn? I'm sorry. What?
No, well, actually, both places. New York. There's a reason that mass shootings happen in New York. They are gun free zones. You know, they're basically victim disarmament zones. Shirley, what do you think?
Yeah, they have a minimum on the magazines. They have a lot of gun control bills out mm-hmm. in New York. And you're absolutely right. I mean, if more people were able to defend themselves. And if these stories were getting out, but these stories don't get out. And that's why I do what I can to publish them on social media and push it out there. There's a lot of times when firearms save lives, but they don't want you to know that. They want to look at the negative of a firearm, not the positive, because that's not their narrative.
Well, where's the NRA? Why aren't they sponsoring ads in papers? You know, they make millions of dollars every year. You know, where are they? I mean, they publish a thing in the Armed Citizen. It's called the Armed Citizen. It's been the NRA, you know, American Rifleman and their other magazines, you know, for years before there was an internet. They were publishing these exact stories, guns saving lives. But the only people that read them were NRA members. And that's not who needs to read them. They should be buying ads in the New York Times. you know, gun save lives. You know, once a month they should have a huge ad in every paper in the country, in every major news site. They should be, in fact, the news organization, One American News, Newsmax, Fox, should be doing major stories, you know, a documentary at least, you know, once a month or more with an hour devoted to where guns save lives. I mean, what's the problem here? This is the solution. Then we're in a media age.
Exactly. I totally agree with you. And I'm also looking into, we kind of touched base on this last Friday, a national day of, you know, how firearms save lives. And I'm going to look into that and see what it takes to have a day, you know, because you have, what, National Donut Day, National This Day, and that day.
It's funny. I was just thinking about national... I love it. I absolutely love it. In fact, let me give you a round of applause here. I was just thinking last night, I was thinking, you know, we got to go over, Shirley and I have to go over all the things we talk about and go over our notes. And I'm sure you're taking them. I get a little bit busy here, you know, to do that. But if you can keep a list of those things as here we go. This is what we need. So good for you. Yeah. National Gun Save Lives Day.
Yeah, or even we can make a month of it, you know, because I did look into
Gun History Month. Gun History or Gun Rights History Month. Yes. Yes, I love it. Write this down. DC Project announces Gun Rights History Month or Gun Save Lives Month. That's hard to say. Guns Save Lives Month. That's too hard to say. We got to be clever about this. Pianki, what do you think? What do we need a name for this? How about just Gun Month? No, Gun Month isn't good enough. No, Gun History Month. That's easy to say. And then you can put in how guns save lives and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Oh, the liberals would go crazy. This is great. The gun phobes. So we need a new term. Gun phobe.
Oh, yeah, they would.
Gun phobe. What's a gun phobe? That's somebody who has a pathological fear of guns that needs to take them away from everybody else because they can't handle them themselves. That's a gun phobe. So we need anti-gun phobe bills. Yes, I did. Not just now. I've used that for a while. Gun phobe has been a long-time term of mine. You never heard it before?
Oh, okay.
Write it down, Shirley.
No.
Add it to your list. You're growing gun phobe.
Gun phobe.
I would put a dash between it so people actually notice the F-O, the P-H-O-B-E part. Gun dash phobe. In quotation marks.
How are you spelling phobe?
P-H-O-B-E.
Phobe.
Phobe. As in a phobia, P-H-O-B-I-A. Gun phobe.
Gun phobe.
Gun phobe. Yeah, I put a dash in between gun and phobe so that it's pretty obvious because you put gun phobe together, it looks like a strange word. People don't recognize it. They don't see it. It's like homophobe, Islamophobe, all the phobes that the left makes up when they want to make you feel bad. Okay. So we're going to make them feel bad. You're a gun phobe. Gun phobe.
That's a good one. So anyway, that's what I was looking into. I did find some place they wanted money. I have to really dig deep because one place says you just sent an application in, another place wanted some money, so I'm not sure which. If you're sending money, I'm not sure about that. But
no,
anyway,
but
we'll check into that.
DC Project could sponsor this nationwide, and just why don't you hold your own Gun History Month? And start scheduling activities. Start now for 6 months from now, or do it in October, right before the election.
But I need to find out more about this national holiday month type stuff and make sure there's not one out there that nobody's even,
Let's look it up right now. Let's look up right now. National Gun Rights Day or something like that. Let's see if we can find it. Anyway, Shirley, feel free to elaborate on something. I'll look this up real quickly. National Gun Rights Day.
Okay, while you're looking that up, I'm going to talk about something that happened with DC Project. They were out testifying. Holly Sullivan was on our advisory board. And she was testifying at a subcommittee hearing, and they were discussing the Jackson Elias Domestic Violence Survivor Protection Act. And that was an incident where a Connecticut woman was shot and killed by her estranged husband, and it took place in 2014. And DC Project was there testifying or against the bill, and basically what it's saying that right now, if you have a permanent restraining order, you're not allowed to purchase a firearm. But if you have a temporary one, you can still purchase a firearm. They want to take that right away. So that if a temporary restraining order is placed, you have to render your firearms and you cannot purchase one.
I know what this is about. This is like red flag laws. This is about disarming basically men. this is where this goes.
It's basically is, like you say, red flag law, which basically says that I can accuse you of, you know, being mentally unstable. They'll take your guns, and then you have to prove that that's not true. Mm-hmm. This would be the same thing. You would be basically found guilty until you proved yourself innocent.
Yeah, but it's called prior restraint.
In my situation, yeah, I mean, I had a restraining order against this person that I, you know, abused me, held me hostage, threatened my life. I had a restraining order, but I am against the because a temporary restraining order, nothing has, there's still facts unknown. It's just that I said, he said, she said, whatever. Mm-hmm. So it is not, I mean, someone could say that to me and my ability to defend myself would be taken away. So they're, I understand what they're trying to do. They're doing it the wrong way. I mean, I think we just need to really punish the criminals and make them accountable for their actions. Women in domestic violence situations, I feel they need to be able to defend themselves.
Yeah, it's criminal not to. You know, and it's not just women, but anybody in a situation, but especially, you know, women, you know, who can be victims, you know, to not be able to have firearms is crazy. I mean, that makes no sense. In fact, there are domestic violence situations that are caused by the abusers, the attackers, the stalkers, the murderers who report their victims and get a restraining order on them so they can't defend themselves. You know, and
well,
then
exactly.
And then they attack
situation,
them.
I mean, when I was up there filling out the paperwork at the sheriff's office, he was coming in and he wanted to say that he was abused, that I beat him. If I hadn't got there before he did, he would have initiated it because he knew that, you know, I mean, he tried. And you're right. It's just, it can switch around just at a, you know, click of a finger. But Bianchi's right. There's situations where, you know, media's not covering situations where women have used a firearm to save themselves in a domestic violence situation. That's happened. I've read stories on it. Mm-hmm. So it's just that the media is not covering them. And I think we need to really, I think I'm going to really pursue this either day or month.
I just looked it up. There is no such day. There is no such month. I coun't find anything.
Well, we're going to claim that pretty darn quick.
Well, go for it. You know, DC Project Presidential Gun Month. You know,
I think
you're onto something.
And,
yeah. Well, get some help too, because there are groups. There are groups that'll help you. The NRA won't, you know, but there are other groups that I know Florida Carry. We'll talk to Jim when he comes on. But I pretty much guarantee that Florida Carry would help with this as well. So take the lead, you know, and it's so critical. Go ahead.
And I would think that a lot of, Florida Carry and everybody would be, because we need to bring attention to this and the media is not doing it. And maybe this is the start of how we can do it.
You use their stuff against them, which is kind of funny. Yeah, but it's so critical for women. Women are going to save our gun rights, just as black conservatives are going to, you know, save freedom politically. There are certain groups that can just do things that other groups can't. You know, I realize the limitations. You know, no one's announced, you know, on the news that I'm the first white guy to start Action Radio or be an Action Radio host. Hasn't happened yet. Why? Because nobody cares. You know, and when the first, you know, black lesbian construction worker from Venezuela becomes an Action Radio host, they're going to get more applause than I will in the news. I mean, it's going to happen. This is the world we live in. You know, it's kind of crazy, but that's how these things work. Oh, I had another thought, too, that if the passenger, remember the passenger who landed the Cessna Caravan in Florida from the Bahamas flight? You never heard about that.
Yep.
If they were a member of a chosen minority group or an LGBT person, they would have been in the White House that day, you know, celebrated on camera,
true.
given the Presidential Medal of Freedom. But it's a white guy, so he never got anything. He just disappeared. Strange world we live in.
You're absolutely right. I would like Bianchi's opinion on the. I don't know. Is he still on?
Oh, he's still on.
On the Jackson Elias. If he has any thoughts on that.
He will. Go ahead, Bianchi.
On the what?
He was having his baby formula. Making his baby formula, excuse me. Sorry.
Yeah, let me put my apron down. I'm making baby formula. What was the question?
For the grandkids. Jackson Elias. Yeah. I think you may have to recap. Let's give the just like I did a recap. We got 10 seconds.
Okay. Take
your time,
Sherry. Yeah, so there's a bill in which they want to be able to take your firearms away from you if there's a temporary restraining order against you. Their goal is to somehow use that. And I think, you know what they're doing? They're using the pandemic of domestic violence to pass bills. Because as soon as you put domestic violence, everybody wants to stop it. So I think they like to roll things up in it and attempt to do something about it when it's really not. They're just another way to chip at our freedoms and our rights. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted, because right now, if you have a permanent restraining order, then it can keep you from purchasing a firearm. But they're trying to change that to a temporary. So if I have a complaint against, you know, Greg, and I say, oh, we need a restraining order, then, you know, you're right to have a firearm. So
how did I get into this? We haven't even met yet. Yeah, no,
well,
good question.
It's one of those questions. I have to be more detailed than if restrained you from if you went in a bank and tried to rob it. I mean, I need more detail on it myself. But I'm kind of I don't want people. My neighbor that I was cutting grass at 7:05 in the morning be calling and wanting them to red flag me the way these things can happen. Nor did I want to have serialized bullets either.
Yeah, that was the plan. Like the $100 Daniel Patrick Moynihan years ago wanted to put $100 tax on a bullet. You know, the stupid thing. Well, here's a question for you, Shirley. Is there any? I'm sure there isn't, but it'd be interesting. Is there any provision, just by chance, that once the temporary restraining order expires, do the guns come back, or can you purchase guns right away? Is there any provision for that, or does the order stand even though it's a temporary restraining order?
I did not see anything like that when I read it. Actually.
How about that? Yeah, how about that? So the temporary restraining order becomes a permanent gun restriction. Oh, that's interesting.
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, well, this is why I asked the questions. You don't have to have the answer. But it's something interesting to point out that is this a temporary, you know, kind of deal? What this comes under is called prior restraint. And this is something I worked on with Jen Clark in Australia when we made our Australian Bill of Rights. You guys should all take a look at that. There's so much in there that we could use in our country too. One of the things we banned were laws and policies and regulations and court decisions that authorize prior restraint. In other words, you know, penalizing you or finding you guilty for something they think you might do. Okay. The whole point of being in a free society is the government does not have the power to guess. You know, you have to wait till an action's taken. And this is why it's so important to be able to defend yourself. Because you don't arrest people ahead of time. Otherwise, everybody, you arrest a ton of innocent people. If the world is, if our country is innocent until proven guilty, the government can arrest you for what they think you might do. We'd all be arrested. We'd be in the gulag tomorrow. Action radio would be done. You know, and people, well, you might be a domestic terrorist. You might be a subversive. You might be a, you know, whatever it is you might be. You might be a capitalist. You know, can't have that. You know, so whatever they think they want to arrest you for. This is why it's so important not to have prior restraint. Okay. And so people say, well, what about prevent the crimes? But yes, you can prevent the crimes to a certain extent. If someone declares some stuff on Facebook that they're going to murder a bunch of people in Buffalo, you can go after that person with everything, every investigative, you know, tool at your disposal. They've already declared themselves, you know, a violent felon. But until then, you know, then you have to do the regular investigation stuff following due process. That, you know, law enforcement is harder in a free society because you don't want to ensnare everybody, you know, while you're just looking, just fishing. That's not how free societies work. Go ahead, Bianchi.
Does the restraining order always also be applied when you're trying to drive your car, use your Vegematic? How far does it stop?
I think it's just guns. They hate guns.
Yeah.
Shirley?
Yeah.
Okay, hold on, Pianki. All right, Shirley?
In Buffalo, that criminal that went and was killing people.
Assassin. I'm calling him an assassin.
They had evidence on him.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we take action on people that we know are bad or not right mentally, or if they've had issues with? It's like everybody knew about him, but oh, we're just gonna let him go anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, the crime is an integral part of gun control. Murder is an integral part of gun control. You need the murders to push the gun control. I know that sounds cynical, but I absolutely believe that, you know, or they're just negligent. They just don't care. You know, it was like I was a flight instructor before 9/11, before the instructors were having Saudi, you know, nationals sponsored by Iran, you know, coming to flight school saying, I want to learn to take off and fly an airplane. But when it came to landings, no, I don't need to learn that. I mean, I would have been at the FAA so fast. I went to the FAA with a person I thought was dangerous. You know, shouldn't be allowed to learn to fly at any flight school because he was suicidal. And I reported that person immediately. You know, and so I know because he almost killed me. This is one of those, you know, one of those many times, you know, we've been a little too close to death. Thank you very much. But the point is that, you know, you can do something. Now, whether the authorities do something or not, that's another matter. I mean, the FBI did not, you know, and the FAA did not recognize that Saudi, you know, nationals sponsored by Iran were going to board airliners and ram them into the World Trade Center. But the flight instructors knew because they reported it. And that's on the record. Same thing here. If somebody publicly declares on social media that they're going to, you know, assassinate kids in a school or assassinate people in a shopping mall, or they're a white guy who wants to kill black people or a black guy that wants to kill white people, that is more than probable cause for an absolute search warrant and full investigation and everything you want. They've already declared themselves. It's like saying, I'm going to rob a bank tomorrow at 6 o'clock. You know, oh, okay, great. We're going to investigate that, you know, to do. But if you want to do something about it, then DC Project might want to work on a government negligence statute, government negligence. In other words, you should have known if someone has the job of law enforcement and they have the evidence and they refuse to act on it. You know, you might want to say, okay, fine. You're going to lose your pension. You're going to lose your job. You're going to be in jail for failure to act. Okay, so if you want to do some kind of restraint, let's do a restraint on government people. So the government always makes themselves immune, but government doesn't have the power to make themselves immune. You know, and I was going to bring this up yesterday with Jonathan. Where's the immunity clause in the Constitution that the government can't be sued, that individual members of the government can't be prosecuted for failing to do their job? You know, companies are held liable all the time for product liability, all the way up to the CEO. Now, granted, the company funds go first. That's why people have limited liability. So you can only sue the company. You can't sue the individuals. But if someone is criminally negligent in a corporation, they go to jail. Remember Bernie Madoff? Remember him, the investment guy that ran the Ponzi scheme? He's in jail. Yet he ran a corporation, an investment company, but he was personally liable. So why aren't government people personally liable for an absolute failure, a blatant failure to act on somebody that already said they're going to go shoot a bunch of black people, you know, somewhere? That's a failure. We need a government negligence or a government accountability. Yeah, go ahead. You know what I'm talking about.
Here's my question. Where does the buck stop? Because, you know, the law enforcement and then there's seniority and there's, you know, everyone over top of them. Who says that you should not be doing, you know, oh, here's mm-hmm. the report. Oh, we're not doing that. You know, is it mm-hmm. the actual person that's doing the you know, footwork?
Good question.
Or is it their superior? So then you have to worry about where the buck stops or who's calling the shots. I mean, I totally understand what you're saying, but I think like the FBI, and they need to take these things seriously. I don't know if they're not taking them seriously or they don't have the manpower or they're
well,
just,
they got plenty
again,
to investigate parents. They got the manpower for parents. They've got the manpower to arrest people that were, you know, walking through the Capitol January 6th taking selfies with statues. They got plenty of manpower for that.
Well, that's
you know,
true.
So,
you made a good point there.
they got it when they want it. You know, they got plenty of manpower to distribute illegal aliens around the country with airplanes, buses, and everything else, and to open our border. They got plenty of manpower. You know, they got plenty of money too because they're sending it all to Ukraine. You know, so it's not a resources issue. The government is way too big anyway. But we need some kind of, you know, in other words, if you file a report with the government, should there be a private entity or a separate government agency whose sole job is to record, you know, reports to other agencies that can be held later when something like this happens, and then the public record can be disclosed. Well, this was reported on this date, and this was reported on this date, and this person was reported here, here, and here, and here are 15 different reports over the course of 3 months that this person was dangerous, you know, and then you start totaling them up. And it's like, oh, wait a minute. Well, where did the report go? Then you put the person that took the report, and then you put their superior, and then you follow up the chain. And if there's a criminally negligent – I mean, this is a big statute. This would be a big statute to hold government people criminally negligent for failure to act on obvious – stuff. You can just do the minor stuff, but obvious problems like this, you know, the Parkland shooter, they had the school program where, well, they were, you know, all school kids are good, even when they commit, you know, robbery and mayhem and things like that. And they had this one of the Obama programs, that didn't hold school kids accountable. And some of them ended up assassinating their fellow classmates. You know, similar kind of thing here. I don't know how you do it because I don't think it's been done. But the prior restraint needs to be on the government people, not on the people. That's who we need
exactly.
to restrain.
And I think they need to have an explanation. Whoever's in charge of the FBI, if they knew about this, why did you not pursue it? Why isn't the government pursuing and questioning them? Instead, they're like, well, I guess we can, you know, the answer to that. We've got, you know, emails that are lost from the Clintons and, yeah.
Well, I have a bill for that, by
forget
the way.
That question.
No, actually, that's a good question because I have a bill for that. I wrote it up a couple of years ago, government accountability bill. And what it says is that anything that's put in a memo, any directive, any policy, anything from anywhere in the federal government goes into a master vault in Congress. Now, they can't look at it all because that's communications within an agency. However, when Congress subpoenas documents, they don't have to wait for the agency to send them over 5 years later. They're already in Congress in the vault. So you have an index system. And so everything is indexed. And you can look up, you know, these subpoenaed documents. You know, once you know what you're looking for, you can go directly to the documents at a time and person and place and everything sent from them. It'd be like if you wanted to investigate Hillary's Uranium-1, you know, giving away 20% of our uranium to Putin. People forget that, by the way. So there's your Russian collusion, all right? So you go back to the State Department, and you put the time that Hillary is there, and you do a nexus search, I believe it's called, you know, a word search for anything that has uranium-1 or oil or any of that kind of stuff. Uranium or anything that mining, payoffs, you know, you do a search. And then you come up and you subpoena, Congress subpoenas the documents, which they can do, all right? Well, the documents are already in Congress in an electronic storage vault. They don't have to wait for the agency to hand them over because the agency's not handing them over because they think they're above Congress. You know, agency people who think they're above everything, including President Trump. I mean, their agency's doing – look at Milley, who called his counterpart in China, you know, to in a treasonous act against President Trump, saying if Trump's going to do anything against you, I'll warn you ahead of time. You know, my Chinese brother. You know, that kind of stuff should be in an electronic storage vault where Congress, once they subpoena a document, it's immediately available. There's an idea for you. DC Project can get behind that.
Yeah, there's an idea. And then – that was the other thing they threw in with the assassin, I'll put that, from Buffalo. Mm-hmm. He's a Trump supporter. I heard that, and I went, what? Where'd
nope,
that come from?
Not true. Not true. No, he's a leftist. He's an eco-fascist. I've already got documentation on that. I was going to do a story on that, but we got guests and other things happening here. But, yeah. Yeah, no, that was already well. In fact, if you look at most of the murderous assassins, they're all leftists because leftists are more violent. You know, you look at a conservative, you look at a patriot, you look at an independent. The conservative, patriots, and independents don't resort to violence first, but the left does. The left is all about violence. They'll kill a million people just to force an ideology. They don't care. It's the group, not the individual.
Al Sharpton played that, tried to blame Trump for his ideology.
It's kind of funny, huh? All right, Jim's on the line. Let's bring him on here and join our happy crew, and let's get his theme, and away we go.
Out of the forests of Virginia to the swamps of southern Florida comes a great man who carries a big gun, probably a Desert Eagle 50 caliber. He served our nation in the military. He protected the citizenry in law enforcement. And now he is a director of Florida Carry, trying to make the Second Amendment as written a reality for all Americans. He is Jim Dykes with the Second Amendment Report for Action Radio.
And Shirley, just let us know before you have to go and make sure we get your contact information. Jim, welcome to a really interesting Friday. How you doing?
I am doing well. How are you, sir?
Having a great time. So let's ask Jim right away the big question. Would Florida Carry support National Gun Month or National Gun Rights Day?
Oh, I love that idea.
Yeah. Okay. Shirley? Care to elaborate?
I'm on it. No. I'll be working on it. we were talking about having declaring a national month or a national day called, well, we're talking about Gun Save Lives, but Gun Rights Day. I like that, too. The other one was Gun Rights History Month or Month Day. So we're batting around different names for the day.
Yeah, I like National Gun Rights Day and then Gun History Month. I think they're simple, straightforward. You don't have too many S's in the way, confusing your, you know, your diction and pronunciation. But that'd be my vote.
Yeah, but well, if it gets our point across,
I'm sure that
guns stay alive.
Yeah, I'm sure if they end up doing a Gun History Month, they'll make it February and make it the shortest month.
Well, it's already Black History Month. It's already been taken.
We can have multiple months.
Well, we should.
Pianchi?
You should have this day in gun history, practically every day.
That sounds good. I'm up for it. You, both of you are welcome to do like a call in for like 2 minutes. This is this day in gun history. I'll make it a daily feature of the show. Absolutely.
I
see
will
how
do
fast
that
we move around here.
After I retire and I don't have a full time day job, I'll do that when I have the time to go and research something every day.
Oh my goodness, Jim! And how close are we? Can you say?
Oh, I am not close at all because I am thoroughly convinced that no matter how much money I make, my wife can spend it. So.
This is the man who went to Ireland for a couple of weeks and, you know, was doing the pub report from virtually every place. And a great job he did, too. I mean, I was following the pictures of all the whiskey and Guinness places that you visited along the way. Great tour. I would do the same tour myself. Yeah, youngster, that's okay. When you get a chance to retire. I guess I'm in my 60s. I can say that. But don't see me slowing down. I have no intentions of retiring whatsoever. I'm having way too much fun. This is the first time I've really enjoyed a career since I was a flight instructor. So, yeah, this is too much fun. All right, Jim, Shirley, do you have anything else you want to add? And let's get your contact information right now just in case you have to go. So let's do that, and we'll get to Jim.
All right. If you want to contact me or want to learn anything about DC Project, go to dcproject.info. If you're interested in getting a copy of my book, Heels to Holster, Survivor of Domestic Violence, you can go to Amazon and purchase that. And that's it for my segment of DC Project Women and Gun Rights with Action Radio.
You are so good at this now. It's amazing. I want you to be a guest host, Jim, too. In fact, Pianchi as well. I'm going to start doing guest host hour, and I'll just kind of sit back and let you guys present topics, and I'll tell you when there's a caller, and you can take them, dump them, do whatever you want. I have audio clips available. So if you guys want to guest host an hour, you know, feel free. Just let me know.
Sounds great.
Ooh, that's dumped them. Yeah, you both would be great at it. Pianchi would be great at it, too. You know, so anyway. All right, thanks, Shirley. Stick around as long as you want. I mean, feel free. I don't know how your schedule is, but you're always welcome, you know, anytime you want, any day of the week. So feel free. Jim, what's going
yes,
on?
Sir.
Good news, bad news?
Make
my day,
you know,
ruin my day?
As always, it's a mixed bag. So we start off with a story, and I actually wore a T-shirt today. You know, you can't tell because we're on the radio, but...
yeah,
I'm
no
wearing
kidding.
A T-shirt that has one of my favorite H.L. Mencken quotes on it. That is, every normal man must be tempted at times to spit on his hands, hoist the black flag, and begin slitting throats. So, a great
tempted.
Sentiment for how frustrated
does, tempted.
The normal man can become. And I wore that today because while every man may be tempted to do that,
yeah.
There is definitely a time and a place not to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so our first story today comes out of Florida, where a Florida man in Flagler County got into a road rage confrontation with a motorcyclist and pulled out a knife and eventually took a swipe at the motorcyclist with his knife. Now, fortunately, the motorcyclist's girlfriend or wife, whichever she was capturing all this on her cell phone camera. Mm-hmm. So he took a swipe at him with the knife, and the motorcyclist was carrying a concealed weapon and drew his pistol. And fortunately, it ended there. The police came, and the person who tried to swing the knife at the motorcyclist was arrested and charged with assault with a deadly weapon. I will tell you, after watching the video, there was no good person in this road rage confrontation. They were both out of control and very angry and yelling at each other multiple times. Either one of them could have left the scene, and they chose not to. They chose to stand there in a standoff, yelling at each other. And, you know, I will also say that the motorcyclist who had the firearm was very lucky that the person with the knife was not very skilled with the knife, because the draw of that firearm was very slow and very clunky, And as close as that motorist with the knife was, it could have ended very, very badly for that motorcyclist if the knife-wielding person had had some skills in knife fighting.
Yeah, it's one thing I learned from my limited time in law enforcement. I was a customs inspector before they changed everything over and dumped all of us older guys for the young kids that they were bringing in, is that a knife is in many cases far more dangerous than a gun at close range, because you cannot draw, aim, and fire a gun in the time that a person can cover. I don't know if you want to say exactly. I know how many feet. I don't know if you want to say that or not, just to sort of give it away. But it's a pretty sizable
20 feet.
Okay, fine. Pianki's going to do it anyway. Okay, fine. 20 feet, yeah. So now that we've said it, but the point is that that's a long way, and most gun encounters are like, what, 5 or 6 feet? So the time that someone could draw, aim, and fire a handgun, and the time that someone with a knife could stop them from doing that in the process is much more likely, as Jim says, with someone that actually knows what they're doing with a knife. I mean, they train you that in law enforcement, right? Knife avoidance and in combat and, you know, resistance and, you know, firearm drawing and when you can and can't. You know, so a knife is a deadly weapon, Jim.
Yeah, and you know, one of the other takeaways from this is you need to practice drawing your weapon. Right. This person who drew his weapon obviously had not practiced doing so very often. Mm-hmm. And I would suggest also practice drawing your weapon while you're retreating, because if someone is coming at you with a knife, you need to put distance between you and them and increase the time that it takes them to get to you. So if you can draw a weapon while moving backwards and using your offhand to prepare to defend yourself, you need to learn how to do that.
I also need to draw one-handed, you know, especially if you have concealed.
Yeah.
A lot of people are raising their concealment garment with one hand and then drawing the firearm with the other. Well, that takes one hand away from defending yourself against a knife attack.
Right. And you know, that is one of the arguments in favor of having an open carry law is mm-hmm. – If you have
faster.
An open carry law, you don't have to do that. You can draw more quickly, and in a knife fight, those fractions of a second can mean a lot.
Mm-hmm. Do they make basic retention, like a law enforcement holster for civilians? I remember in customs, it was pretty simple. It was a retention holster, but you just had to pop a flap off, and you could draw it incredibly quickly. Are there things like that for civilians? Because the argument is always open carry. Someone might come, you know, behind you and grab your gun kind of thing. That's
so
one of the arguments against it. Yeah.
Yeah, retention holsters can be purchased by civilians. I don't know of any state that has any kind of law which precludes you from purchasing a retention holster.
Mm-hmm.
But I would also add there is very, very, very little actual evidence of instances where a civilian who is openly carrying a firearm
mm-hmm.
has the assailant attempt to take his firearm from him.
Okay, that's good. That's good to know. Yeah.
Yeah. What the places you see that happen, and the reason why law enforcement officers use retention holsters, is it typically happens during the actual making of an arrest, when you go to ground with someone and mm-hmm. they have decided that they are not going to go back to jail and they're going to do whatever it takes not to go to jail. And so they see a holstered firearm on the law enforcement officer who's wrestling on the ground with them, and they try to take it.
Okay.
You just don't see people trying to take a holstered firearm from someone because it's difficult to do, it's dangerous to do, and you risk getting shot if you do it. So, you know,
yeah.
criminals tend to be cowards, and they look for soft targets, and someone openly carrying a firearm is not a soft target. I guess if you were very, very elderly and looked like you couldn't draw your weapon quickly and wouldn't be able to keep it from someone, then they might try to take it from you. But like I said, there are very few instances. There are a handful, but there are very few instances of someone taking a firearm from someone who is openly carrying it.
Interesting.
Not only that, the gun they take may be the one that's unloaded. The other one in the pocket's got the bullets in it.
Yeah, multiple guns. You know, if he had like an empty holster inside, you know, arm, like an old Western holster, and then inside you had a shoulder holster, you know, under a shirt or something like that. You know, a shoulder holster could be, you know, so you put your arm over it. You have great retention capability of that. So there's all these options that people don't think about. Let's look at Shirley into this too. Shirley, what do you think? Motorcycle carry for women?
Motorcycle carry for women.
I know. I just thought of that.
Carry no matter what they're in.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think how do you carry on a motorcycle? I guess you'd be the same way. That would have to be an open carry, wouldn't it? Otherwise, you'd never get to it.
It can carry on your body. I mean, but okay. What Jim was talking about in that instance, people are very aggravated very easily. And you got to keep in mind that to turn or to walk away or to de-escalate the situation is sometimes would be a lifesaver. I mean, like you said, but neither one of them seemed to be one. I didn't see the video. We're backing down. You know, like you said, you can leave in that situation. But
I agree with Shirley 100% there. As I get older and hopefully more mature. I'm not sure I'm getting more mature, but hopefully
I'm definitely
getting
not.
More mature. I don't want to get into a confrontation with anyone now. I'm perfectly fine with leaving and breaking away from the situation. You know, I don't feel like I need to get that boost of testosterone from having a confrontation with someone. If I can break away from a confrontation, I am happy to do so now, and I wish more people would do that.
Yeah. Are there courses in either of your organizations, Florida Carrier or DC Project, that talk about mental disarmament, about de-escalating a situation? You know, the fact that you have a firearm actually gives you more confidence that you can probably take the chance to say, hey, look, I'm sorry. Even if you believe you're absolutely right, to say, look, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do whatever happened. Like, let's just, and I'm just going to back up here. I'm just going to go away and, you know, And I'm done. And I'm not going to argue with you anymore. And just to, you know, find a way to speak calmly and just say, okay, because I've apologized my way out of things that I didn't do, you know, just because the confrontation wasn't worth it. There's no reason to. You know, so there's a lot of, you know, it's part of martial arts training is to when not to fight, knowing that you can, but knowing that you don't have to. In the same way, you know, if you're carrying a firearm, you know you can fight, but you don't have to. And so that's, I think, part of the confidence that you can get by carrying the firearm, that you might be more likely to de-escalate or try to de-escalate a situation.
Yeah, Florida Carry actually doesn't offer training. But I can tell you that I have taught classes in mindset and situational awareness, and that is a big part of it. You know, you should try to avoid confrontation when you can. And there's nothing wrong with backing down from a challenge from someone. I'm perfectly fine with that. If, you know, you're trying to impress whoever you're around, you can impress them. That's fine. As long as you're impressing them, doesn't put me in danger. Once you put me in danger or the people around me in danger, then we're going to have the problems.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. I mean, if you have videos on that, I think that'd be good to post video on that from either of your groups. It'd be great to know, or your own personal stuff. Yeah, Pianki, go ahead.
Yeah, Jim, I see where Orange County was sheriff was having a gun buyback. Do these programs work?
Sorry,
of course they
always crack me up. Well, why do they call it buyback? They didn't own them in the first place. They're not buying them back. They're buying them. Jeez, God. I'm sorry. Jim,
yeah, so I have many problems with these supposed gun buybacks. They don't work. There's been no credible research that showed that they have any influence at all on crime. One of the other big problems I have with them is when they do these buybacks, part of the buyback is they take the gun from you. They give you in this case in Orange County, a $50 gift card, and there is no ID required and no questions asked, which means you have a stolen gun that you want to get rid of and not have a problem. Go to a gun buyback and give it back to the police. They won't ask questions. They'll take it away from you and they'll destroy it.
Well, don't they at least check the serial number to see if it's stolen?
I have not been to one, but I can tell you it says no questions asked, no ID required.
Jeez, that's dumb. See, now this would be the perfect opportunity to turn that around and give those guns to folks of lower income who want to exercise the Second Amendment rights. So we should call it the gun buyback redistribution, you know, to the, you know, low income access, you know, program, self-defense program. Turn it around. In fact, it would be a great thing for Florida Carry and D.C. Project to propose. Next time you hear about one of these stupid gun buyback things, I don't know if you're going to buy them back, but at least check them out, see who the original owner is, and then give those guns to people that can't afford them to defend themselves.
That'd for a long time, I had said I would love to go set a table up next to one of these gun buyback places and offer $100 and have people come over and look at the firearms, and if it was one that I really want, give them $100 instead of $50 and take it off their hands.
We should do that. See, I'd drive. I mean, anywhere in Florida, I'd be there. Shirley, what do you think?
Didn't somebody do that?
Well,
the
problem that you would run into is you would quickly run afoul of federal law, because it would be very easy to say that you were in the business of buying and selling firearms if you did that. So unless you had an FFL, you would probably be arrested.
I'm sure half of Florida County has FFLs.
It seemed like somebody did something like that. I can't remember the specifics, but I remember someone setting up a tape in the news or somewhere. I read it. I don't see, but because of that memory, when you get old, you can't remember all this stuff.
You guys talking about yourself being old. Pianki and I are both laughing at you two youngsters. So, you know, just crack me up here. Well, you can look it up. Anybody, you know, either of you, in fact, all three of you, Pianki, Shirley, Jim, feel free to look something up. If you can't remember something, you know, I look up stuff all the time on the show here. You know, so if you got a minute where one of the rest of us is talking, usually me too much, then just look something up. Go find it and then report back to us. I mean, no problem at all. That's how we found the baby formula yesterday. What about homemade baby formula? And of course, you know, Pianki's remembering back to his past, you know, his great grandparents, and we kind of went from there. So, you know, feel free. Yeah. Anyway, Shirley, I'm glad you
heard it in St. Louis.
Yeah. What's that?
I heard it going on in St. Louis on one occasion. And also, the St. Louis Police Department auctioned off about the, I think it was 25 Thompson machine guns. And it was a long line that was trying to get in on that.
I'd be there. In fact, we had – remember we had Josh Whitehouse Wednesday. He's from New Hampshire. He's a New Hampshire former state representative, ended up in the Trump administration, liaison to the Defense Department, basically trying to clean the swamp or drain the swamp. And he was partially responsible for getting rid of folks from advisory boards like Henry Kissinger, Medal, and Albright, and a bunch of other people. It was a really fascinating show, if you haven't heard it, Wednesday afternoon – Wednesday, the third hour. So there – yeah, it's some interesting things going on out there. All right, and I forgot how I got onto that. I was going to look up something else up here. The bill that was just passed, Jim, I don't know if you're going to cover that, the domestic terrorism bill, which is basically the white guy's bad bill. I don't know if you heard that one.
Yeah, I've heard about it.
Okay. Is that part of your thing, or I can save it for the third hour?
No, in fact, I want to get to another one really quick just while Shirley's on, because
go for it.
This is always fun when we can combine our two segments. And anytime I can give a shout out to DC Project, I want to do that. So I wanted to talk briefly about some testimony that went on 2 days ago in DC for a Senate bill called the Lori Jackson Nicolette Elias Domestic Violence Survivor Protection Act. And there
That's
is,
the one
there
that
a lot
Shirley was talking about. I think Shirley talked about in your first part of your report, Shirley. Say, Max?
Yes, it is. But go ahead.
We'll get your take on it, Jim. And now back to you, Jim. It'll be like a regular news program. Back to you, Jim.
There was a lot of misinformation put forward by gun grabbers during that testimony.
Hmm.
But Holly Sullivan, a very well-known DC Project, is she still a member of DC Project, Shirley?
Okay. Yes, she is, and she's on the advisory board.
Perfect. And she's also the head of one of the Connecticut groups also, I believe. She did an
Correct.
Outstanding job of giving her story of having to survive domestic violence and use a firearm, and also debunked a lot of the myths that were being perpetuated by the anti-gun groups there. Probably the biggest one was that when Lori Jackson was killed, her husband actually went to Virginia and purchased a firearm and then came back and used that firearm. And the anti-gun groups were big to talk about how he went down and bought this firearm in a private transaction and legally purchased a firearm and brought it back and killed Ms. Jackson. And this is why we need stronger gun laws. When the fact of the matter is, it was already illegal for him to go to another state and purchase a handgun. Under federal law, what he did was illegal and made him a felon. So he didn't purchase the firearm legally. The fact that he went and bought it from a private citizen doesn't mean anything. If there was a law in place that said there had to be background checks in place, there is no evidence that he wouldn't have gone and found someone willing to sell it to him in spite of that law. He found someone who sold it to him illegally when he was from out of state, so wouldn't be hard to find someone who would sell it to him illegally even if he wasn't out of state. So, and she did a great job of that and many other things. So I will actually post an article that gives a lot more details of some of the talk that she gave in the Senate committee to the website. I'll post that as along with the video of the knife fight that I was talking about earlier.
Well, I want to see the knife fight one, but I've also already posted Holly, I forgot her last name, her testimony. You know,
Sullivan.
I post two things.
Oh, perfect.
On, Holly Sullivan.
Oh, great.
I post two of them on the gun group last night. And so I sort of grab you guys. So when you post articles, I immediately put them over to the gun group. Yeah. So just save me the time. Just put them right in the gun group. Just, you know, whatever you do, just share it right to the gun group. So that way we'll have those. But yeah, I want to get her testimony. Of course, now you know I want her on the show, you know, Shirley. So feel free.
All right. I'll work on that one.
Okay. Yeah.
But as always, great work being done by DC Project once again up on the Hill. So hats off to them.
Do you guys want to do a joint report? Should I just like start you both together? I'm serious. We just combine your reports. We'll talk off the air, but I want to find a way to do more stuff. Or I was thinking of actually maybe Shirley start at you know, half an hour earlier, go for 45 minutes. Jim, go for another 45 minutes. That'll take us up to Derek at 7:30 my time. We got to talk. We got to do more with you two because you're so good at this. That and you know, we'll talk off the air. Yeah.
I want to thank Jim for you know, giving us a little promotion there, but Holly did. She did an excellent job, and that's I think where we have a lot of women that are really good at that. And I had Lauren, remember Lauren on the show last Friday.
Lauren stayed the whole show. She stayed the whole show. She
I know.
Was fabulous.
All the people I have on the show stay the whole show, and I have to
they
go.
They do, yeah. It was the New Zealand woman. You had a competitive shooter from New Zealand. She stayed the whole show. So everybody you bring on, you leave, and they stay. It's hysterical.
But you were talking – something came to mind when you were talking about he illegally got the gun, right? If this person – people don't – I don't think it's the common sense they're not thinking about. If this person wanted to kill his ex-wife or his, whatever their relationship still was, he couldn't get a gun. He's going to get a knife. You know, it's not like there's not another way. If a criminal's going to commit a crime, he's going to do whatever it takes to commit that crime.
Yeah, and another point, too, I want to ask Jim the same sort of similar thing. It seems to me that the left is more concerned with how somebody buys a gun with the fact that they committed murder. You know, the buying the gun illegally seems, or legally, or just buying a, you know, a gun at all seems to be a far bigger crime in their mind than however many people are killed by that gun. Jim?
I agree. The fact that they're attacking the purchase of a firearm is ridiculous. There are plenty of laws in place already which would, if laws worked, would preclude dangerous people from getting firearms in most cases. Now, there's always going to be someone who was not dangerous, never showed any signs of this before, and their initial crime ends up being murdering someone. But by and large, most people escalate their way up to that, or they have a mental illness, or they go purchase a firearm illegally, or there's a laundry list of things that happen. So the laws are there. The laws are not enforced well. All you have to do is look at the number of NICS checks that come back and the left touts as having stopped a prohibited person from purchasing a firearm and compare that to the number of actual prosecutions that occur. And you find that either the federal government doesn't care about prohibited people purchasing firearms, or more likely, they're all false positives, or most of them are false positives, and the people weren't actually prohibited, and they're touting someone who actually should have been able to purchase a firearm as having been prevented from doing so.
Shelley, you had a point earlier when I sort of tossed my question. Did your points get addressed with Jim? I know she's there somewhere. Unmute. Going once, going twice.
I'm sorry, what?
Well, I sort of stepped on your point that you were making for Jim, and then I asked my own question, and then I realized that my question was different than your point, so make sure your point got addressed.
No, that's fine, but then what Jim was saying, I got a question. You're in law enforcement, correct?
Former law enforcement.
Did you find it frustrating when you would actually arrest somebody and see them out on the street the next day or next week? They just bailed out and they never really got prosecuted. It seems like that happens a lot these days.
So I'm a dinosaur in spite of what Greg will try to tell you. So I was a law enforcement officer quite a long time ago. And I will tell you, I did get very frustrated not having them getting bailed out the next day. Oftentimes it was because they were being bailed out before I had even finished completing my reports. So I was actually still sitting at the police station watching them walk out, and I hadn't even finished the report on the arrest yet.
Oh, my gosh.
How did that happen?
Because most of these guys have a bail bondsman on speed dial.
Oh, geez. What a racket. That's why all the bail bonds people around the courthouses. We have that here in Milton,
they are.
And our courthouse is moving, but yeah.
Yeah. Huh. But I didn't see a whole lot of people who I thought should have been prosecuted not being prosecuted. Now, there were some cases of plea agreements that were offered that I thought were too lenient, but that's a judgment call. You know, you could argue both sides. You know, there is a reason that they do plea agreements, and, you know, justice is often served by them. It's sometimes frustrating to the law enforcement officers because they were actually on the scene and saw what happened to the victims of the crime. So there was some of that, but I didn't see a whole lot. In fact, I can't remember a single case where I was involved in an arrest of someone who I thought should go to jail who was not prosecuted.
Oh, that's good. All right, I tell you what, Jim, why don't you give your contact stuff now in case you have to leave anytime soon. Derek's on the line. We're going to talk economics. God knows, there's nothing happening in the economy these days.
Sure.
I love this report. Yeah, so go ahead and do that, and then we'll get Derek, and then we'll hack into all the horrible things that are happening with the Biden insurrection.
Sounds great. I am Jim Dykes with Florida Carry. You can reach Florida Carry on the web at floridacarry.org. You can reach me directly at my email, jim@floridacarry.org. Thanks as always, Greg. I appreciate it, and I'll talk to you next week.
Oh, you got to go? Oh, that's not
fun.
Great.
I will have to jump off here in a minute.
Okay. Well, we still got Charlie and we got Pianchi, so let's get to Derek.
I was going to tell Jim to be safe.
Money. What is it? How does it work? How do you get it to work for you? So many choices. Stocks, bonds, mutual funds, commodities, and then there are the markets. Oil, gold, manufacturing, trade, energy, even government. To make sense of all the places your money can go, Derek Park of Edward Jones Financial Advisors joins us Fridays at this time to make sense of the markets and your money. Well, it looks like both Shirley and Jim had to leave. But we're going to work on that report. I got to see what I'm going to do. I'm going to see if I either combine the reports or give them more time or sort of use that first half hour. I haven't quite decided yet. I'll figure something out. But and also Chappie, who's normally in the top of the hour, is going to be sort of scheduled as needed when he has guests and things like that. So we're going to have that hour open. So, Derek, you're always free to, unless we have something scheduled, you know, hang on for a few more minutes after the top of the hour to continue our very vociferous, you know, discussions of the economy. Good morning, sir.
Hey, morning. How are you guys doing?
Well, I'm $40 billion poorer. The vote went through. I'm fine. Pianki, you still there?
Oh, where the money could have been spent.
Or not spent. No, I mean, the biggest problem.
Hey, I got an idea. We could have used that to build back better.
We could have built a wall. We could have built several walls. We could have had an insulated wall. We could have had a wall within a wall. You know, $40 billion.
Well,
I heard somewhere that $40 billion is the entire Russian defense budget. So we basically gave Ukraine the Russian defense budget, military budget. That's what I heard.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that?
I don't know. I'd have to look. Yeah, I don't know what their defense budget is. I know ours is upwards of like $700 billion.
Which is interesting because they give $1.5 trillion to stimulus. They give another $2 trillion to so-called Build Back Better. They spend about $5 trillion, and yet our entire defense budget, all the military bases, all the aircraft carriers, all the stuff like that, all the payroll, everything that goes, all the food, you know, all the missiles in the ground, all the things that we have cost $60 billion a year. It's not even $1 trillion for our defense. And yet,
yeah,
you know, the government prints money and spends it on all these things. You know, I don't think the defense budget's all that high in comparison, considering the Constitution puts most of the responsibility of the federal government on defending the nation. That's the number one priority, the border security, the military. It should take up, you know, somewhere upwards of, in fact, I talked to Dr. Walter Williams about that. About 70% of the budget should be the defense of the country. The state should be handling everything else. Ooh, there's a thought.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's I think it's a little, again, my personal opinion, at certain times, I think we do spend a little bit too much on defense budget, you know, because maybe that's a better way to put it. I myself have seen, you know, wasteful government spending, mm-hmm. you know, and just, you know, I don't know if that's money that came from the defense budget because, I mean, you know, very, very amateur at the time. You know, but the bottom line is, I mean, I think we definitely could find it to a certain place and let it sit mm-hmm. at that certain place a lot longer, rather than, you know, inflating it and then inflating it in times of war, you know, would be a little bit more useful for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But when
then
I
all
say,
we do is give it, then all we do is give it to other countries.
Yeah. That's another problem too. Yeah. And then we surrender and give our arms away. My point is, when I say that the military budget could easily be 70% of the federal budget, I'm not talking about raising the military budget. I'm talking about cutting the spending of everything else. The federal budget, constitutionally, should be a little over $1 trillion. And in fact, I made a video on that. I don't know if you've ever seen it. And I wrote a report on that, too, for Intellectual Conservative when that website was up and running before it got hacked. And they're back up and running, but my articles and most of the articles I have to reprint somewhere else. But that's the thing. So we figured out that a constitutional budget these days would be about $1.5 trillion. So if half of that's military and half for everything else, we'd have about a $3 trillion surplus that we could put into national debt reduction. And that would solve our problems. That's what I'm going to propose to Trump, you know, when the day comes, when we get him on the show, that he needs to take some really big and bold steps to get us out of this mess. That would do it. Literally going to a constitutional Article 1, Section 8 budget.
I agree. You know, something better, or but at least better transparency.
Well, we got a bill for that, too, the 30-day comment period for any bill over $100 million. In fact, I got that to Josh Whitehouse, former Trump administration official, liaison to the Defense Department. Did you hear Wednesday's show? I think you might find that third hour quite fascinating.
I didn't, you know. I mean, I've, you know, obviously with the wonderful market volatility, I'm a little bit more busy than usual.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Drive time. You know, to and from your boat. You listen to Action Radio.
I don't have one of those. I have
a
jet ski, though.
Oh, that's just, okay. So I see you on the water. I see you on the boat. Okay, so this is the investors, you know. Well, how about the cost of a jet ski versus a boat as people are scaling down with the price of fuel? That thing doesn't use a whole lot of fuel, does it?
No, not really. I mean, it holds like 18 gallons. It gets like 7 or 8 miles to the gallon. I know that doesn't sound like much, but in reference to a boat. that's high.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it'll go roughly about 100, 110 miles on a tank. They cost roughly about 10 grand. I didn't buy any super spiffy model. I got one that was basic. I built a rack for the back of it to put a cooler or hold fish in.
Yeah, your lunch. The lunch rack.
That's right.
Makes sense to me.
They're super efficient. I mean, I've owned mine for 5 years now, and I mean, other than maintenance costs, I tell you, I probably got less than $1,500 wrapped up into them.
Yeah, and this is kind of a metaphor for what's going on right now. In fact, the title of the show, The Great Gasoline Revolt of 2022, my idea, we're trying to pick a price at which fuel gets to, and when people start standing and picketing outside the doors of not Congress in Washington, because they're going to barricade themselves in, but the district offices. I think there's going to be a revolt in this country, somewhere around $7.50 if gas gets that high. And the impetus for my thought was the fact that a friend of mine sent a story to me, and in fact, it's in the UK reports, the United States reports. I've got a couple of articles, actually I've got three articles on it, one including gasoline rationing, that Washington State, the canary in the coal mine, the place where they killed the seniors first with COVID by putting it in the nursing homes, are fixing their gas station machines, the pumps, to accommodate $10+ a gallon fuel. That's huge. What do they know?
Yeah. Well,
so
I mean, when you come in swinging, you know, because you're all worried about Green New Deal, everybody's going to pay the price, and they are.
Well, here's an interesting question for you. You know, I mean, I'm picking $7.50, $3 more than the price is now as the threshold at which people are going to go, that's enough. We're not going to wait for the midterms. We're going to start picketing, you know, Congress, screaming at media, holding all kinds of things. People are going to revolt. And I think the crimes at gas stations and gas, you know, tank seizures and stealing and hijacking of gas stations to pump fuel and, you know, all kinds of things are going to happen. But if you had to pick a price, is there any historic level? I was looking for like the threshold of revolution, you know, when the whiskey rebellion took place or any of the things that are product-based rebellions or revolts. Is there any percentage? Is there anything? You probably don't know. This might be a future, research question. But at what point do people say that they've had enough? You know, maybe even another country should be a guide. But there's going to come a point when Americans have had enough.
You know, I don't know specifically, and mm-hmm. That's really hard to say. But, if you go back and look at, like, the two big times our market has had problems,
mm-hmm.
This is just an interesting statistic that I've noticed. I don't know if there's any writing on that. The past three, if you include this one now, when the market had problems, oil was topped out. That's like, it's almost like it's correlated. Oil was over $100 a barrel during the dot-com bubble. Oil was over $100 a barrel it was pretty close to $100 a barrel during 2008, 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2014, when we had like the U.S. credit issue, our credit rating was downgraded. We went through another oil crisis. It was $100 a barrel. And then where we're at now, you know, so it's, there's a very weird correlation, between, you know, our problems in the market, that we're having, which are direct result of the economy, what's going on with the price of oil. So that's the only thing that I've noticed. I've noticed another weird correlation for the past 6 months that whatever cryptocurrency is doing, the market's doing.
It's fascinating the way this works. Now, I think the highest price oil has ever been was, I think, somewhere around $140, $150 a barrel. So it can go higher.
Oh, it can go higher. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I'm just using like market where the market price was based on the two big producers. Mm-hmm. Exxon and Chevron, where they were at that point in time. So, you know, I'm not exactly sure what the barrel price was. I mean, I could go look at Brent crude, I'm sure.
But oil, the price of a barrel of oil is not at its highest price, and yet the price of gasoline is at its highest price. So there's a little disconnect here.
Yeah, I mean, there typically is.
Okay.
You know what I mean? You have to understand there is costs associated with transfer of you know, that stuff. And if that cost is up, so will the cost of the resource that makes it move. You know, I mean, it's almost like we should have had a pipeline or something like that.
Oh, funny you should say that. This is when the energy, you know, secretary gets in front of Congress and Josh Hawley says what she's saying is absolute nonsense. And so, well, this is all on Putin. I mean, give me a break. We all know what the cause is.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get to the report and then anything you want to talk about. And we have a little extra time if you have extra time. I think I'm going to this whole gasoline thing in the next hour. But yeah, go for it. What do we got?
Okay. All right. Well, good morning. This is Derek Parker, Beverly Jones, bringing you the daily financial market report. Stocks traded lower again on Thursday following Wednesday's sell-off as concerns continue to mount over potential recession. Earnings announcements from the large retailers this week have set a more cautious tone as they reflected two opposite forces at play. One around a consumer that continues to spend but is shifting consumption habits, and another around a punitive impacts of rising costs and ongoing supply chain disruptions. A defensive tone has played out in performance recently, though leadership today indicates a more mixed picture with the materials, communications, services, and consumer discretionary sectors leading, while consumer staples and industrials lag. Bonds and gold were higher, while oil prices and small cap stocks were weaker, reflecting the worries over the demand outlook. We don't expect the volatility to disappear anytime soon, as markets will be changed to find more firm footing. The U.S. equities closed lower today, with the Dow Jones down 237 points or 0.75 to 31,253, and the NASDAQ closed down 30 points or 0.26 to 11,388. And the S&P 500 closed down 23 points or 0.6 to 3901. In the bond market, the 10-year Treasury yields were trading at 2.85%, lower by 0.04. In the commodity markets, the price of crude oil was up $1.87 or 1.75% to $108.91, and the spot price of gold was up $25 or 1.38% to $18.41. This is Derek Parker, Beverly Jones, member SIPC. You can get me at 850-995-0082.
Interesting that the price of oil has been 108. It's been pretty stable for a while. I don't know how far back, if you have like one of those trend things or any of those you know, sort of recording projections, but I remember it's at least 3 weeks that the price of oil has been, you know, hovering in that 108 area. Am I right on that? I'm pretty sure I am.
I've got a resource. I'm gonna log on real quick here and see if I can get it.
Yeah, we'll just guess in the meantime. Let's get Bianca on the line. Bianca, you have any economic questions or comments at this point? And then as Derek's looking up our oil price trend. Bianca?
No, it's a pretty good report.
Derek's great. You know, Derek doesn't realize it, but when we get 10 million listeners, Derek thinks he's busy now. When do we get 10 million listeners to Action Radio? So we'll show you what busy is, Derek. You have no idea what's coming. But it's coming.
Oh, no.
You stick with me now, then when we get huge, you know, you get all the benefits. So that's part of the deal. Anyway, I'm serious about that.
I've got
a trend? Got a trend in oil price?
I see here that the high, where is this? Yeah, so 2009, its high was 148.
Ooh.
Or 2008 when the market pulled back.
Okay, what was the price of gasoline then?
I don't have something. I can only look at the oil.
Okay, well, we'll take that.
During the dot-com bubble was – doesn't show it that way.
Well, actually, 2008 is enough because you think about it, the price of oil was basically – it was almost a third, let's say maybe 25 to 30% higher than it is now. And yet we're the highest gas prices we've ever had. Now, are those corrected for inflation when it's like 481 or whatever it is people are paying nationwide? Is that corrected for inflation so that we can have a consistent scale? Because here's what I'm curious. is the ratio, the percentage of the price of gasoline related to the price of oil. In other words, if oil goes to $150 a barrel, does that translate to $5 a gallon at the pump kind of thing? Or not, because I don't remember gasoline being as high. I think even in those bad days, it was and I was in California, so it was like $3, maybe $4 was as high as it ever got. Now it's like $6 or more, and they pay more than $6 in San Francisco. And California has a problem because they have a special formula of gasoline. California does not buy gas from any other state. They make their own. So they have a finite supply. They got a closed market, and that screws up the price. That's why California gas is always higher by about, a third because they're idiots. And they only have three refineries making gasoline for all of California. And usually one's down for maintenance. And if something happens to another one, that leaves them with one. And that's when they really get screwed. But gas wasn't that high. The highest oil price does not translate to the highest gas price, which I find fascinating. Gas is steadily increasing, which means there are other factors here. Lack of supply, pipeline, lack of fracking, lack of exploration of Western states, which is state land instead of federal. All those things. There's a bunch of other things applying that weren't there in 2008. Can you think of anything, any of the factors, that, like I mentioned, that were different? Because we weren't embargoing our oil. We weren't – who was that? That was Bush was president, right, 2008? No. Obama took over in 2009. There was still Bush policies.
He took over, yeah. So it was end of 2008 was Bush. And then, Obama took over beginning of 2009.
But there were no restrictions. There were no pipeline restrictions. They weren't putting, billions of acres into the National Monument, Antiquities Act thing and taking all this that land off. The Bush oil policies were okay. They weren't as good as Trump's, but they're still pretty good, So that's why you didn't have as huge a price with the most expensive oil. Would that make sense?
Yeah. It definitely would. When you have transportation costs and things up, that's going to make a huge difference, definitely.
Yeah. Well, the cost of a pipeline versus the cost of a train or trucking oil has got to be huge. Once the pipeline's built, what is the cost? Just basic maintenance? Pipelines are incredibly cheap once they're there. All the costs are in the initial setup of the pipeline, I would guess.
I would imagine so. There is a large setup costs, but obviously, it's probably going to reduce the cost because, it's going to reduce transportation costs. And that's really what you're looking at. That's causing things to be very high right now when transportation costs are up. You're talking about a chain reaction of
right.
transportation costs, probably driving costs at least 20-30% of the factor on everything else. So everybody's really worried about inflation. Really, if you wanted inflation to go down, just lower the cost of transportation. And it's all of that gets passed directly to the consumer. It's cause and effect. It's pretty simple, it definitely is something that's going to be a huge impact.
Oh, yeah. I remember visiting when I took my daughter up to Alaska years and years ago. In fact, right before the 2008 collapse, we got back just as it was starting to happen. I visited the Alaska pipeline, and it's there, and it's a little bit warm. It's kind of nice, and it's quiet. It's silent. You can't hear anything. And you've got this huge pipeline that's 10 feet thick, and oil's just bopping down there, and there's no obvious cost to it, as opposed to a truck. Or a train, you're paying a per mile cost for your energy. So you have to spend money just to get your energy, which you're going to spend more money on because it's more expensive because you're spending money moving it. So pipelines
I think
would be by far the cheapest form of getting your energy because a pipeline, like I say, once it's built, other than leaks and preventive maintenance, there really shouldn't be a cost to it.
No, I would imagine so. I wish we could get an oil person on there. It'd be nice.
Look for one. I know people in Wall Street. I know you're like a financial whiz. You're internationally known, as a guru of finances. Just come up with somebody. We'll find them out there. Like I said, when we have 10 million listeners, they'll be calling me. What was that, Derek?
I said, it's that easy, huh?
That's what I – hey, listen. Hey, we're going to have fun here. Pianchi, do you have a question or a comment?
No, but the pipelines are the safest – transport for oil. from one destination to the other.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they're actually green.
And you'd be surprised of the number of pipelines that's already intertwining throughout the country. From Texas to the East Coast, for instance, there's a huge pipeline that allow refineries to tap off of when they're in order to get their supply of crude oil in order to make their finished product.
Yeah, do you think big gasoline trucks are racing down the streets of Manhattan? No, it's all by pipeline. Get real, from New Jersey. You know, I mean, think about it, folks. I mean, when's the last time you saw a huge gasoline truck in a big city? It's pipeline. You know, that's just how they do it. Let's talk about the word recession. Recession, to me, seems inevitable. I mean, you can't have this kind of spending, especially just dropping $40 billion, which Congress did so willingly because they've been guilted into it. That means people have no spine. They're absolutely worthless. You know, spending $40 billion for Ukraine, you know, it's guaranteed to raise the price of everything. And, you know, the Fed, they've got, here we are, accelerator and the brake. You know, the Congress is stomping on the accelerator, creating the inflation, and the Fed's got to stomp on the brake and hope that the brake is stronger than the accelerator. I think that's where we stand now as far as recession.
Well, I mean, you know, I dare say this, but I've had to build a picture for some people. So
okay.
The dirty R word. So, yeah, well, I mean, you're an econ guy, so you understand this. So let me build a picture for you. We've already had one quarter of negative GDP, right?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't
right.
down by far, but it was one quarter of negative GDP, right? We're six
mm-hmm.
weeks into the next quarter, okay, 6 weeks already. And we just had three of the big three people report negative money. So you're talking about Amazon, talking about Walmart, talking about Target. All three of them have just reported, profit losses, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you put that together with one quarter of it that you already had of negative GDP. Where do you think we are?
I think we're in a recession. You know, and
exactly. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I'm not trying to
there.
Build a picture and say, you know what I mean? Everybody's starting to say, so typically when the recession word comes out, you know, we're already past it. You know what I mean? The recovery has began. You know, I dare say it to people, and I've been saying it for several weeks, even a month now. I mean, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, don't think that it can't happen. Well, what the economists are saying is, oh, well, we've got record low unemployment right now. Okay, well, you've also got a huge number because you shut the economy down, and then
you're
fill
paying people not
people
to work.
Back up with
yeah.
Right. So you've got a little bit of a skewed number right now. So who cares? So is the rule for recession to say that you can't have low unemployment? No, the rule for a recession basically says two consecutive quarters of negative GDP. That's it. You know,
mm-hmm.
period, exclamation point. Doesn't
yep.
say anything in between. So ideally, you know, while the fundamentals say no, I mean, we pretty much, I mean, I'm not going to say that we're there, but, you know, I mean,
I will.
It breathes well.
I'll say it, we're there.
It breathes really well.
Yeah.
You know,
this is nice thing about being the host here. I can say
this. Yeah,
things.
The good news story about this is, and I tell people, you know, I do tell people this. I say, okay, listen, you know, the inflation report last month was 8.5%. The inflation report this month was 8.3%. So that's kind of a good news story. While it's still high, I get
oh,
that.
Oh, you're such an
you
optimist.
I mean?
8.5, 8.3.
It could have been 8.7.
It could have.
So, you know, if it was 8.7, that would mean that it isn't going the opposite direction, right? So, you know, I mean, that could, I mean, it could just be a month where things kind of dip down and everything's going to go back, you know, go back up after that. I doubt it because there's and I forget what they call this, but it's like basically consumer confidence and consumer spending. All those
mm-hmm.
numbers are going down. So if all those
well, yeah,
numbers
but
are
that's,
going down.
That's a recession too, you know, because it's a behavior. There's an economic recession and there's a behavioral recession too, right?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're
okay.
absolutely right. So what I was saying before, which I said several months ago, you know, I mean, basically people weren't paying attention to the fact that costs were up.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, consumer confidence was still high. Spending was still high. People were just like, forget it. I don't care. You know what I mean? I'm just going to keep buying. Well, that's caught up now. So,
yep.
you know, I mean, I saw another report that says, you know, they have a meter to see how full the parking lots stay, basically, you
mm-hmm.
know, and they're noticing that that's down roughly 20%. from what
the parking meter gauge?
Is that the parking lot gauge we're using? How full the parking lots are, you know what I mean? And they use that as an
estimate, the parking lot. That's fascinating.
Right, right. So anyway, so all of this stuff is down. So, you know, I mean, it may have already caught up. You know, the good news is, you know, once they report here in about 6 weeks and say, okay, hey, we had another quarter of negative GDP, the recoveries began. So, you know, I mean, it's I don't know. I mean, I would expect eventually if the dirty R word starts coming out that the president's going to have to get involved because every president in the past has. So once
the guy that's in South Korea right now, congratulating them for creating jobs, that person, Brandon, is that who you're talking about? I'm sorry. It's just kind of funny. Well, here's the question, though. The behavioral recession versus the economic recession, the numbers document recession. If you've got people that are changing their lifestyle, and I just heard this report on the news, too. People are canceling vacations. They're combining all their errands. You know, the restaurant that they used to go to every day for a cup of coffee and, you know, eggs and bacon and go chat with their friends, they're going once a week instead of 5 days a week. You know, people are cutting back already hugely. And I think that 8.7 to 8.5, that to me is point, you know, 2% recession. That's already there. And so whether the economics have declared it or not, the behavior of people has declared it. You can't raise gas over $4 a gallon and not have people cut back on something. I'm just glad I don't have to do my delivery job as much as I did before, you know, but, you know, because things are doing better, you know, for me here and the show is growing and life is great. But quite honestly, you know, the Uber drivers, the DoorDash drivers, the, all the delivery services, you know, your companies like UPS and FedEx and everybody that's paying more, there are companies that are based on delivery. You know, they're having huge, unless they're going to increase their cost for their shipping by a huge amount. I can't wait for the next Teamster negotiation, you know, for UPS. That's going to be fascinating to watch. You know,
right.
We don't, you know, but these things, but fuel affects everything. And people don't understand that. Fuel absolutely affects everything, you know, from the fertilizer to the plastics to the cost of transporting everything, including the energy to make electricity, you know. And we had a really interesting show yesterday. If you get a chance to listen to it, we're talking about the carbon cycle. And the fact that carbon dioxide in the air goes into plants, and plants eventually, you know, for those that believe in the biotic fuel, the fossil fuel theory, and I think it's part of it, but I don't think it's maybe like 5%, just a guess. Anyway, so the carbon goes into the plants go into the ground becomes oil, the oil comes up from the ground, gets refined into gasoline, goes into the cars and the vehicles, and they release the carbon dioxide back into the air. So actually burning fossil fuels is recycling carbon, completing the carbon cycle. It's actually the greenest way to go. You're using a natural earth product, putting carbon dioxide back into the air so that it can go into the plants and we can continue the carbon cycle. And if people thought about things that way, they wouldn't have any problem burning fuel. I have no problem burning fuel. I'm going to get a huge, you know, 402 engine Firebird. And as soon as I can afford the fuel and the Firebird, you know, early 60s, that's what I'm going to do. And I'm not going to think twice about burning gasoline. And some liberal wacko comes up to me and says, how could you have a gas guzzler? How could you? And that's that. We haven't heard that term for a while. You know, why aren't you driving? Well, because this is more fun. Well, how can you do that? Because I want to. I'm a free American. That's exactly why. If I can afford the gas, I'm going to do it. People that have SUVs and huge trucks and diesels and all these massive things. You know, you got the cab and the this and that, and all these extras. You got the jacuzzi in the back, you know, where the truck bed used to be. You know, go for it. I don't care because I know it's part of the carbon cycle now. That it's good for the environment. Put carbon dioxide back in. Plants are growing like crazy. There's a 50% increase in, or 100% increase in CO2 in the air creates a 50% increase in plant growth. You know, in the Sahara Desert and the deserts of Australia and the other places in the world, that's huge. So the idea that burning fossil fuels is somehow not environmental is absolute nonsense. It's as environmental as it gets, completing the carbon cycle, as after all, we are carbon-based life forms. And you take in the other thing we discovered, hydrocarbons, hydrogen and carbon are very similar to carbohydrates. The only difference is oxygen, which is what your body uses to burn fuel. Well, hydrocarbons can be burned in an internal combustion engine. But basically, the energy of sugar and the energy of oil are so similar in the atomic structure as to be, you know, it's basically the same thing. So how can it not be environmental? And nobody talks about this kind of stuff. Well, we do, you know, because we're, you know, on the cutting edge of freedom here, and free speech. But think about that. If that were known in the environment, if that were known in the market, that they had the carbon cycle recycle index, you know, instead of calling it the fuel burn index or something like that, that would change everything. That would change terminology for everything that we do. Anyway, that's what we've been talking about the last few days. It's been quite fascinating here.
I think it's interesting. There's a thing, you know, people talk about global warming and that we're causing it, but nobody wants to talk about something called the Milankovitch cycle.
Oh, how's that different from the, there's one I've heard, the I forgot what it is, the 30-year, the slower one, Maunder minimum. I've heard that one. So what's this cycle? What's the Milankovitch cycle?
The Milankovitch cycle is basically says, hey, the Earth is kind of on a tilt. And instead of it just spinning on a solid axis, the top,
right.
You know, the top of the Earth kind of, you know, swivels, you know what I mean? It goes around a circle and, you know, that circle, I can't remember how long it takes, but it basically says that, you know, for about, you know, 15 years or 20 years, don't quote me on this number because I don't know what it is, but it's some type of long cycle, you know, the Earth kind of tips further away from the sun, which is actually the way that it goes at the slant is when it actually global warms, because it, that they show the way that it, yeah, the UV rays like come through at a certain angle. And then, you know, for another, you know, 10 or 20 years, it kind of tips up on its side, because, you know, it's halfway through the moon of the spinning that it does, the top of the Earth kind of tilting. And then it gets to go through the cold cycle. Right. You know, so, because of the way that it is. So, yeah, you got to look it up. I mean, it's, it gets very scientific.
Well, I've already put it down here, yeah.
Understand. I don't know enough about it to continue talking because I'd probably butcher it.
No, that's okay. No, and listen, and you're free to speculate on the show too. You know, we talk about a lot of things that we have to look up because, you know, in the dark recesses of our minds, we come up with stuff like the Maunder minimum is something that I got to get Gregory Wrightstone back on the show. He's big and famous now, so he's harder to get a hold of. But a couple of years ago, when he wasn't as well known, it was great to have him on because he's a climate geologist. So when he talks about climate, he's talking about a million years of climate. Now, do you know if the Milankovitch cycle includes ice ages? Does it account for that?
It may. You know what I mean? Like it's
okay.
It may be something that accounts for a cold cycle. Don't quote me on the ice age.
Okay, no, that's fine. Yeah, I mean, so many disclaimers today. I understand. This stuff is fascinating. But like I said, I love to speculate on these things. But here's something, too, that people don't understand. The Earth wobbles. Otherwise, you wouldn't have seasons. You know, and this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to do a globe. I found a globe at a garage sale. And so I'm going to do a little thing on the globe. And most people don't realize that the Tropic of Cancer, which is when the sun, you know, when we are in the sign of Cancer in the Northern Hemisphere, you know, June 21st is when the sun is at the highest point. And it's only because the Earth wobbles. The sun doesn't move. The Earth does. You know, the Earth tilts.
Okay? Yeah.
So it wobbles up to get the sun, you know, hitting the Tropic of Cancer. And then at the solstices, you know, the midpoints. The equinox. You know, the equinox that happens would be March and September. You know, for the start of spring and fall, you know, the equinoxes is when the sun is at either the Tropic of Cancer or the Tropic of Capricorn. So Tropic of Capricorn is when the sun is at its highest point in the Southern Hemisphere, in the sign of Capricorn, which is January. Okay. So that's when winter starts, you know, so it's the shortest day up here, but it's the longest day down there. People don't realize that because they don't know the globe. They don't know how the Earth works, that it tilts and wobbles, the magnetic field shifts and moves, and all these things have to be accounted for. The Earth is a very dynamic, ever-changing body. It doesn't just, you know, spin the same way all the time. It wiggles, it wobbles, it does what it does. It's a little further from the sun, a little closer to the sun. We get ice ages, we get problems, we get seasons. But if the Earth didn't tilt throughout its entire rotation, we'd never have seasons. People don't know that.
No, sure.
They should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's, you know, the people that you know, that say men can have babies also.
Well, that was hysterical. Did you see my post on Facebook? If men can have babies and abortions, then let's get the first metrosexual guy to come forward with a prescription for the pill. Go ahead, show me. We'll wait.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was good on that.
You know, I mean, it's take me back to the 80s and 90s.
Well, that's the thing, because those that are old enough to remember a time when we had sanity, we had crazy people, but, you know, the entire world wasn't crazy. Let me ask you about Twitter before you go, if you have a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
Two things. One, they were dropped from the S&P, and two, I think Elon Musk has dropped his offer to buy them. I think something got in the way, probably the left. So what happened with S&P? Why did they get dropped from the index?
I saw Tesla got dropped from the index, not Twitter.
Oh, it was Tesla that got, not Twitter. Okay, I'm sorry, I misspoke. Thank you for correcting me. Tesla got dropped, so it was an attack on Musk. Yeah, that was, I wrote it down wrong here. So let's talk about both.
I mean, You know, Tesla. I mean, I and I'm sure there's probably something that motivated to dig a little bit deeper. So, you know, it was dropped from the index because it didn't meet their criteria of being within 25% of some threshold, and I can't remember what it was.
Oh, really?
And it was outside of the 25%, and it basically said, okay, it falls into the category of mega caps, like Amazon, Apple, things like that. So it was dropped from the S&P 500 index.
Because it's too big?
Basically. I think that's the way that it was be put. So, anyway, and you know, I mean, he says it's politically motivated because when you're dropped from indices, I mean, it makes it seem like your value is not there, but, I mean, it's not really going to have any kind of impact on it, I don't believe.
Okay. So the Fortune 500 does not equate to the S&P 500 then? They're two different indexes.
No, Fortune 500 is a rating company for the top 500 best companies, biggest companies, best run companies, and then S&P 500, Standard & Poor's, is a rating company on, you know, the quality of your company that is publicly traded.
Oh, regardless of size?
Yeah, it is regarding in size, because obviously if you're a mega cap, you don't fit in the S&P 500 anymore.
Okay. So if you can be too big and probably too small for it as well. I mean, talking about mid cap companies above.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
The S&P 500 does have small caps, you know, companies that market capitalization is 500 million or smaller. And then 500 million and beyond covers mid cap to, I think it's 500 billion. And I'd have to go look again. And then everything beyond that is large cap. Or maybe it's 100 billion. I'd have to go look again because I don't know where the market capitalizations are off the top of my head. But
that's okay.
We're
going to forget them anyway.
Contains large cap, contains mid cap, and contains small cap.
Yeah. And the Dow is a much narrower range. That's only like, what, 12 companies or 20 companies for
30.
The Dow? 30 companies. Okay.
30.
That's still not very much.
Yeah. 30 of your longest standing, dividend producing, most stable companies is kind of the best.
Fine old companies, good long standing names, been around for 100 years. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, most recently, GE was dumped from the Dow.
That's interesting.
That's a huge thing. Very, very, very huge thing. They were dumped because of their mismanagement of the company, the dropping of their dividend. And they were replaced with Walgreens Boots, WAB.
WAB. Yeah, Walgreens is a good company, as far as I can tell. Although I wish they'd bring back soda fountains. You know, we need those back. the only other thing I had here, what we were talking about before, the term volatility. I mean, you and I know what it is, but listen, is there a definition for when the market is, quote, volatile? Is there a certain amount of activity that qualifies, or is it just sort of a generic, the market's doing a whole lot right now, going up and down?
I would call it more of a generic, but typically volatility is defined when there's an index, a volatility index. It's called the VIX. VIX, it's run by the Chicago Board of Exchanges. And what that basically says is it's a thermometer of how people feel about the market, right? It's basically your sentiment gauge. So, when people say that there's volatility in the market, volatility in the market isn't just, you know, a couple weeks of, you know, ups and downs like that. It's typically defined of several months of, you know, negative movement based on either investor sentiment, based on the economy. I mean, you've got basically three things that control the market, and two of them are very, very similar. You've got investor sentiment, how they feel, about the market. You have fear itself, which is basically the fear index, which rolls into the sentiment. And then you've got the economy.
The fear index? That's funny.
Yeah. Those things, because what happens is, you know, you can tell people all day long, and this is some good education for everybody that's listening. You know, I mean, you can tell everybody, like the post I put, you know, you can tell everybody all day you're supposed to buy low and sell high. And they'll sit right in front of you and be like, buy low, sell high. Yeah, I got it. Well, then the market happens, right? And they see their portfolio down 20%. And they're like, well, you know, do you think we should move to safer investments? hold on a second. When you sat here in front of me, you told me that we should buy low, sell high. Now what you're telling me to do is sell low? You know, or, you know, I mean, just does it make sense what you're saying? You know, so, and then what you're telling me is you want the market to recover, you know, find a higher price for you, and then you want to buy in when it's higher, when everything's all good. Is that what you're telling me? You know what I mean? Like, you know, I have to draw people a picture for this. And yeah, most of the time when I draw a picture and they see how it's not good, you know, I don't want to call them foolish, but, you know, I mean, that's, it is, you know, and then I show them that they're kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, I probably shouldn't do that. That's not the best thing. And I'm like, well, remember we buy low. And then they'll be like, well, I don't want to buy right now. You know, I'm just like, okay.
Well, it's like the inverse theory, you know,
yeah,
fear.
I'm like, how do you think Warren Buffett became?
Hold on, Pianca, I'll get you in a second.
Warren Buffett became a billionaire by you know, selling at low markets and looking for a good entry point? No. The guy just held his cards and just kept buying. You know what I mean? Like, he didn't run away from it. He keeps buying and buying and buying. And that's how you create the wealth. You don't create the wealth by panic selling. Right. You know, and that's just what people do. So, I mean, it's hard. It's hard to control people's emotions.
Yep. Pianca?
Yeah, what did you make a comment on Tesla being delisted from the S&P?
Yep.
Is this political?
Yep.
Well, they realize how wouldn't that not have effect on retirees and those that depend on dividends? And what's the logic behind it? Because Mr. Musk is putting out conservative views and speaking on conservative issues and speaking against the deep state. It's just ridiculous.
Well, I mean, is it going to have an impact on retirees? Probably not, because Tesla would be considered a little bit of a more volatile stock. Now, people invest in Tesla because, you know, I mean, they're looking for an innovative car maker, you know, somebody that's green, that's doing something. So, people buy Tesla for the different reasons. I would say, I'm sure, look, I've got retirees that own Tesla. There's nothing wrong with that, but you're not buying Tesla for stability. I'll tell you that much.
What about the pension funds and so on and so on? And also, he's a great business person, and look at his SpaceX, what it's doing for the nation.
Yeah. So if you're talking about like pension funds or institutional investors, you know, they would probably keep Tesla at a small percentage of the holding, say, you know, 3%, 2%. You know, typically the predominance of the holdings are going to be your Dow, your dividend producing, your solid companies. I would probably venture to say pension funds, that's going to be probably 50% of the holdings, if not more, if it's a stock portfolio, you know, and then they're going to have roughly 40% bonds, you know, and where people's problems are right now is the bond market is tethered with the stock market because we're in a rising interest rate environment in a pullback. So with people with bonds, their bonds are down 5 to 10% on average, you know, between how volatile the bonds are. So we're getting 5 to 10% on top of a 20% market pullback. People's portfolios are down. I mean, if you're in the Dow in bonds, you're down 20%. If you're in the S&P 500 in bonds, you're down 25%. If you're in the NASDAQ in bonds, you're down 30. You know, so, you know, I guess, when you're talking about running pension funds and having Tesla in there, none of the people that I would say that have owned Tesla before they split are upset about it right now. You know what I mean? Now, Tesla was trading at roughly $1,000 a share or more, and now they're down to roughly $700, so 30% back is a huge move. You know, but so is Amazon. You know, Amazon was trading at $3,700 a share just short of a year ago, and, I mean, they're trading at $2,100 now.
Wow.
You know, so, you know, I promise you Amazon's in all those same funds as well, and probably double, if not triple, the holding of Tesla.
Yeah, this is very, very interesting stuff. I'm wondering, though, that well, let's go to Twitter for a second. The fact that Elon Musk is not going to spend $40 billion. Did a lot of people invest in Twitter in anticipation of him buying that and maybe the stock going up? And are they selling
they
now?
I mean, People even call me for it. I just said, you know, if you want to buy a deal that has this much political and news exposure,
You know, you're taking a lot of risk, and it's not something I would ever recommend. So, I mean, okay. Keep in mind the share price is right around $45 a share at that point. You know, the share now is trading at 37. So, you know, I mean, it's gone back another 20% from that. So, you know, and maybe this is part of his plan. I mean, I dare to say, you know, I mean, he's going to get the shakiness of it so he can go back and give him a revaluation. He can say,
make
hey,
another offer.
You know, he can. I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know that they have to accept it, but, you know, I mean, it's I don't know. I don't know how all that works. You know, I mean, I dare be careful. I mean, if you look at another one, for example, there's a company called Activision Blizzard, which is one of the biggest video game makers in the world. You know, I mean, they make they produce some of the best names in video games. They're under a takeover bid from Microsoft. You know, but how much have you heard about that one? You know what I mean? There's nothing political
just now.
To gain there.
Oh, okay.
That.
Just now.
Yeah.
That's the first I've heard of it. Yeah.
Well, exactly. And I mean, it's been going on for 6-8 months, you know, so, Warren Buffett even bought into it because he was pretty sure that it's a done deal. It's a guaranteed way to make some quick profits. You know, so, nothing wrong with it. I mean, you buy that kind of stuff, because the deals are supposed to go through. If the deals don't go through, then the stock price fails. You know, and you never know when that stuff comes out. I mean, they announce the deal, you have a potential to make the money, but if the deal goes sour, then the stock price falls and, you know, you pay the price.
Yep. I just want to let Elon Musk know that if he wants to donate to something good, Action Radio would love a contribution at this so that we can affect our Section 230 bill, which would make it unnecessary to buy any social media company. We would simply make their liability conditional and keep them on the straight and narrow and leave us alone. So that's an option for Elon Musk if you're listening right now. And I do send
I
the press
step
releases.
Out.
Okay.
Give your
information.
Save yeah. a lot longer. But, okay. Well, I hope everybody has yourselves a good weekend. This is Derek Park of Edward Jones. You can get me at 850-995-0082.
Thanks, Derek.
Goodbye, Derek.
Yep. Take care.
Bye-bye.
You know, so I wanted to, I had one more question for him on, I'm glad I could save the extra time. I'm going to have to redo Fridays. I really like starting at 7 o'clock Central, 8 o'clock Eastern, just because it gives me more time in the morning, you know, to sort of mull over stuff. But Fridays,
well,
Fridays are going
to
be a problem.
People are just starting the weekend off early.
Well, that's the other thing, too. I might keep it at 6 o'clock Central Time. And what I want to do, though, and I'm going to talk to Early and Jim about this, is see if I can have more overlap for their reports, keep Derek at the same time. And if he can stay – because sometimes he can only stay half an hour. And sometimes we'll have Donnie Chapman will have some guests, some amazing guests that he brings in from the shooting world. And so, you know, but I kind of like the idea of Fridays being a little early. I don't mind that. But the other days of the week, you know, the hard news days, Friday's kind of more of a fun day. But even though we tackle tough topics, it's still more fun. I never got a price out of him, though, for where he thought the revolution would be, you know, in terms of gas prices, when people are going to start picketing Congress and district offices and things like that, asking for, you know, we want our pipeline, you know, signs like, you know, stop Biden's, you know, energy stealing, or who knows what's going to happen. But it's going to get nasty out there, and it's coming. I know it's coming. But like I say, I figure around $7.50 a gallon is the threshold of revolt. And, of course, California would be more like $10 a gallon because they're used to higher prices. But, yeah, what do you think? And then we got to play Santa Rosa Volunteers.
That's federal government. I think I still contend that the federal government has to be reeled in.
Yep.
I mean, how far can it go? And the further it goes, it's just making more difficult as well as literally impossible to correct the problems that they have, what they have created. I want to see the states, you know, start putting demands out there, putting their foot down, as said in many countries.
Well, you know, we put the word out. We did the show. We did the show in the western states. They can take their land anytime they want. You know, we've done shows about how states, you know, even on the Roe v. Wade question, they never had to obey it. You know, it was never a law. It was never an official policy. It was just an opinion of the Supreme Court. And opinions, you know, you accept it or you don't. But the states were never under any obligation to do that. You know, something else I was going to talk about. It's like the federal government and immunity. The federal government can't give itself immunity. There's no immunity clause in the Constitution that's immune from lawsuit. You know, there's all kinds of government accountability we can do. We're going to be on the forefront of a lot of very interesting movements and thoughts and creations here. When Gates called us, Matt Gates called us the Ideas Factory, I don't think he realized how many ideas that we're able to bring to the country. And of course, as the show grows, you know, I joke about 10 million listeners, but I think it's very possible that the impact that we can have, the ideas that we create, are going to move the national debate in ways that they have no idea is coming. But it is coming. It's going to happen. It's just a question of how and when. What do you think? You know, stick around. I think you're going to have fun with this as the show grows. It's going to be very interesting. You know, there might be people wearing Pianchi T-shirts. You never know.
Yeah, well, that'd be a welcome in for a sore eyes. Absolutely.
All right, let me play a piece here. My last of the Federalists, Anti-Federalist number 11. And so take a break. Pianchi, take a break. Everybody else who has never heard this before, please listen intently. And we'll be back a little bit. We'll close out the week. This is what we seem to do. Pianchi and I'm really glad that you're here, Pianchi, so that we can talk about the issues. I got a gasoline article. You can see what you think of that. And anybody else wants to call in with what you think is the threshold of revolution. What price of gasoline is going to cause Americans to revolt? Like I say, I'm saying about $7.50 a gallon, and we're headed for that right now. Anyway, back in a little bit.
This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Anti-Federalist 11 was written under the pen name Agrippa, who was a Roman general under Emperor Augustus. Interesting choice. It is thought that Agrippa was James Winthrop from Cambridge, Massachusetts. This paper is actually an accumulation of excerpts from letters. So let me simply point out the highlights and develop a theme. The title under which this paper is recorded is Unrestricted Power Over Commerce Should Not Be Given the National Government. So let's focus on that primarily and leave out the other fluff that always accompanies these papers. Agrippa says, "It has been proved by indisputable evidence that power is not the grand principle of union among the parts of a very extensive empire. The common conclusion from this reasoning is an exceedingly unfair one, that we must then separate and form distinct confederacies. This would be true if there was no principle to substitute in the room of power. Fortunately, there is one. This is commerce. All the states have local advantages and in a considerable degree separate interests. They are, therefore, in a situation to supply each other's wants." If you read only the Federalist Papers, you will get one set of facts designed to lead you to only one conclusion, that without the Constitution, the country will fall into factions which will destroy the Union. However, when you read the Anti-Federalist Papers, all kinds of new information, evidence, arguments, and possibilities show up, which proves once again there are always other options. Agrippa then says, "The complaints of the deficiency of the congressional powers are confined to two articles. They are not able to raise a revenue by taxation, and they have not a complete regulation of the intercourse between us and foreigners. For each of these complaints, there is some foundation, but not enough to justify the clamor which has been raised." Whenever you hear intercourse, think commerce and trade, and it will all make sense. Agrippa is saying these are problems, but not enough problem to abandon the Articles of Confederation. Regarding the giving of power over all commerce to Congress and protecting the states, Agrippa says, "Three restrictions appear to me to be essentially necessary to preserve that equality of rights to the states, which it is the object of the state governments to secure to each citizen. First, it ought not to be in the power of Congress, either by treaty or otherwise, to alienate part of any state without the consent of the legislature. Second, they ought not to be able, by treaty or other law, to give any legal preference to one part above another. Third, they ought to be restrained from creating any monopolies. Agrippa counters the argument that the federal government has to standardize all commerce under the Commerce Clause by stating that having the states retain some authority over interstate commerce wouldn't be much of a problem. He says, "The new Constitution not only prohibits vessels bound from one state to another from paying any duties, but even from entering and clearing. The only use of such a regulation is to keep each state in complete ignorance of its own resources. It certainly is no hardship to enter and clear at the custom house, and the expense is too small to be an object." Agrippa then says of the Constitution giving the feds all power over commerce, "The unlimited right to regulate trade includes the right of granting exclusive charters. There ought then to have been inserted a restraining clause which might prevent the Congress from making any such grant, because they can consequently defeat the trade of the outports and are also injurious to the general commerce by enhancing prices and destroying that rivalship which is the great stimulus to industry." Agrippa knew well the value of competition. In the concluding paragraph, Agrippa sums up his objections to taking all commerce power from the states and between the states. "There cannot be a doubt that, while the trade of this continent remains free, the activity of our countrymen will secure their full share. The credit of our merchants is, therefore, fully established in foreign countries. This is a sufficient proof that when business is unshackled, it will find out that channel which is most friendly to its course. We ought, therefore, to be exceedingly cautious about diverting or restraining it. Experience has shown that, instead of trying to lessen an evil by altering the present course of things, that every endeavor should have been applied to facilitate the course of law, and thus to encourage a mutual confidence among the citizens, which increases the resources of them all and renders easy the payment of debts. By this means, one does not grow rich at the expense of another, but all are benefited." And then Agrippa, in the last part, adds his analysis of human nature into the mix to again frame the argument against the Constitution. He says, "It is vain to tell us that we ought to overlook local interests. It is only by protecting local concerns that the interest of the whole is preserved. No man, when he enters into society, does it from a view to promote the good of others, but he does it for his own good. All men, having the same view, are bound equally to promote the welfare of the whole. To recur, then, to such a principle as that local interests must be disregarded is requiring of one man to do more than another, and is subverting the foundation of a free government." In that last sentence, it's quite clear that not only giving Congress the power over all commerce subverts the independence and sovereign rights of the states, but the entire Constitution does, which is the main argument of all the anti-federalist papers against rushing into a completely new form of centralized federal government. Their choice is amending the Articles of Confederation to keep the independence of the states while giving the federal government a better range of defined powers for the good of all the people. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it.
Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Penglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com.
Action Radio, part of the ADHD Radio Network, the ultimate free speech zone. We the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed, and have the power through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. At Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news. Every other show reports what has happened. We talk about what can happen. From the questions no one has thought to ask, to the answers no one has thought to consider, to the actions no one has dared to take. That is Action Radio.
Okay, I'm back with my co-host Pianchi, and we're going to hash out the week as we close out yet another week with a huge week to go next week with the WHO, which is going to try and control everybody through controlling everybody's health, having world health care. National health care is bad enough. I didn't want to go with that. That's going to be Monday's show. So, Mari, I'll be working on that over the course of the weekend. Pianchi, anything particular on your mind that you want to cover, or do you want to talk gasoline revolt, the great gas revolt of 2022? Got to mute, dude. I know you're there somewhere. He's probably making coffee, sitting back going, Greg doesn't want to talk to me. Yeah, I do.
Oh, it's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting how the public respond to it and what those responses are going to play out when it comes down to elections.
Well, do you think people will wait for the midterms? That's my big question. If gas is rising at the rate that it's rising, where every day it's at a new, you know, world high for us, or a national high in price. At what point do you think, if we're at $7.50 a gallon in, say, July, do you think people are going to wait for the midterms in November before they start screaming and yelling and protesting?
I think that people should start utilizing the power of recall. Could you imagine if you had about four or five, maybe a half dozen or more recalls going on around different states at any given point in time?
Yeah. Well, we do have an election coming up, though, in November. I mean, the midterms is a big chance. It's, you know, the two times you really have to recall your politicians is the midterm and the presidential election. And the presidential is that attracts the most attention, most voters. Midterms are pretty – this one's going to be a big one. All the voting is up. Democrat voting is down, but Republican voting is way up.
Well, you know, after watching documentaries and video in counties like 2,000 Mules, if you had rather than November, if you had elections going on all year long due to the effect of recalls, then those factions that put together the infrastructure for 2,000 Mules couldn't cover it all.
The Senate said the problem I have with recalls, because you get too close to a democracy and get away from a republic. There are times when politicians, through leadership, have to do unpopular things. And if you have the amount of money that we have to throw around in this country, suddenly being spent, if somebody wants to lower the gas prices and the oil companies or the government is actually funding a lobbying effort against those politicians, you know, a recall. And what if the people behind recall are George Soros? What if the people behind recall are Planned Parenthood? You know, what is it? You know, these you got to be really careful with this kind of stuff, because a lot of times the best politicians are the ones that take the most unpopular views at the times. So the folks that I congratulate right now are the ones that voted against the Ukraine aid. But there's only 11 senators that did that. You know, and so many House members. Well, I got the vote here. Let me pull it up here. Senate passed. I got a Breitbart report. Let me see if I can get the report for you real quick. $40 billion Ukraine. You know, but yeah, you got 12 senators: Marsha Blackburn, John Bozeman or Boozman, Mike Crapo, C-R-A-P-O or crap. I don't want to say crap all this. Mike Crapo, Bill Hagerty, Josh Hawley, Mike Lee, Roger Marshall, Cynthia Loomis, Rand Paul, Mike Braun, and Tommy Tuberville. All voted against the $40 billion for Ukraine, which means that our own senators in Florida, Rick Scott and Marco Rubio, voted for, you know, aid to Ukraine. So they need to go. You know, I send them right
out of people.
Go ahead.
You say people like Josh Hawley. See, there was a movement from the left with demonstration in downtown St. Louis, with demonstrations there on Market Street in the park. With factions wanting to get rid of him. Mm-hmm. It was basically an early on recall. I mean, think of school districts, for instance. Mm-hmm. Not only do the Constitution have an on-off switch, but your child don't have an on-off switch where you can turn him off until you get a school board that's going to do the right thing. And then when you get a school board that's defiant, the only way to solve that is to get rid of him.
Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't have recalls. I'm saying you shouldn't have easy recalls, because the tendency would be to recall, to redo the legislature. You know, in the same way as the Supreme Court justices are subject to good behavior, it should be a frivolous procedure to remove them simply because a majority of Democrats, you know, in the Senate want to get rid of the conservatives. You know, so there's always the flip side. There's always the abuse side that you have to watch out for. So I love the idea of recall. They recalled Gray Davis, you know, back in California when I was there, over MTBE, which is methyl tertial butyl ethylene, something or other. It was a ridiculous additive to fuel, you know, before, I guess, ethanol or some other things. Anyway, it was killing people, and Gray Davis was all for it. You know, I would recall, in fact, I would impeach, because they're not doing it, Dr. Fascist. Should never have gone beyond, you know, March of 2020, you know, pushing vaccines when we knew we had cures. He should have been out of office for that. But that would not be frivolous. That would be life-saving for upwards of 1 million people who were killed by Dr. Fascist, as far as I'm concerned, by being denied early treatment. So you figure 950,000 approximately of the 1 million people that have been killed by COVID were killed by government policy, not COVID, government denial of treatment. You know, so that's, you know, it's like our oil situation. We're being denied oil because of government policy, not because we don't have oil. We got plenty of oil. You know, but you got to be careful in recalls, because what if the people who are being recalled are the ones that are voting correctly? Like these 11 here. So say these 11 had all of a sudden, because they voted against aid for Ukraine, you know, Soros comes in and starts recall campaigns on all of them. You know, if it's easy to do, then they're going to be gone, because you can buy votes. This is the problem with the democracy. You know, you can buy votes in a democracy. In a republic, there are rules and laws and rules of evidence and due process and things like that. And the rights of the minorities are protected, including unpopular politicians who are doing it at the right time that will be viewed by history correctly, but at the time are hated because it's not the popular thing to do.
What the nature of the reason for the recall has to be the will of the constituents that their representatives are supposed to represent.
Okay.
You know, the assessment of people in the northeast corner in Vermont and New Hampshire may be different from those down in New Mexico and surely those in Washington State and Florida. So, no, I think that constituents, the people that these politicians are supposed to represent, politicians have to be aware of and afraid of the knife that's being held over their head. Either you do the right thing, either you do what we sent you there for, or we have no use for you. Why would you put up with something that's no good?
Good question. No, like I say, I don't mind recalls, but you've got to have a provision in there. And it should not be easy, but it shouldn't be as hard as it is. So if you have an easier recall procedure, but it's still a reasonable one. And again, you've got to make a provision. You got to have the argument. And you got to have people willing to put up the money on the other side of Soros is trying to get rid of them, like these district attorneys. There are some truly horrible, disgusting, despicable district attorneys out there that are freeing people that need to be in jail. They should be recalled. I think there's a case that San Francisco is trying to recall their DA. LA, I think, has tried to recall their DA, but they're having problems because it's too difficult to recall them. So again, easier policy, but not so easy that it's frivolous, that people can use it to get rid of their political opposition. That's where the problems come
in. And then again, that gets down to another point of the education of our young people in the United States. Our young people are not taught along those lines. They surely aren't taught the civic duties that the generation of the 1950s knew about, and also you've seen them implement that in various methods, like at the polls. So, no, I think that all these work hand in hand. You got to have an educated populace that's literate, up to date on the issues, and also know the responsibility of government and better the limitation of government, especially the federal government.
Yeah, I think there should be a basic familiarity with the issues and a constitution, you know, test. but the best way to do that is not at the polls, but to do it in school. You know, you can't graduate high school until you have a certain amount of constitutional literacy. It's just basic stuff. But again, it comes back to the fundamental problem that governments will never educate people about limitations to government. There's no class on government limitation in the public schools. They just isn't, because they don't see a limitation on government at all. Any
governor up there, where is that? What is that governor up there in Oregon? What is she saying that the to prove that you can do math and that you can read the math is not a requirement to graduate?
No, she's an idiot.
What type of society are you creating?
Well, you know, it's interesting. New York used to have an exam called the Regents exam. And you needed that to pass high school. You could not pass high school if you couldn't pass the Regents exam. And every high school kid took it. And so New York was, for a while, you know, a pretty well-educated state. I think they've gotten away from that. And I don't like standardized tests. That's not the way I would measure student competence. You know, in fact, I've got a whole model for education that's completely different. But the point is that it's better than nothing, you know. So the idea that you don't have to have math or that math is racist, you know, everything's racist. No matter what somebody doesn't want, they're racist. I mean, you know, gasoline is racist. They haven't said that yet, but if you want to power, you know, the white man's pickup truck, you know, you're a racist, right? So if you're a good old boy with a cowboy hat and you're in the South and, you know, you pull up the pump with your F-150 and some, you know, twiddly metrosexual weenie dude in glasses, you know, pulls up in a Prius and says, that's disgusting. That's a gas guzzler. You know, F you, pal. I'm sorry. You know, I mean, but that's going to happen. You know, the liberal metrosexual girly men are going to start coming out and blaming, redneck truck drivers for, the problems with gasoline. It's going to happen. You haven't heard the term gas guzzler for a while, but it's coming back. You know, not driving an electric vehicle uses the same fuel to power itself, petroleum, then, somehow you're bad.
I'm reading on a website, Peters and Peterson, and the topic is the national debt, which is over $30 trillion. Mm-hmm. But in one section, one point that they're making, they talk about inadequate revenues. And it goes on to say the U.S. tax system does not generate enough revenues to cover, and I get this, cover the spending policymakers have enacted. Well, that's where things go wrong right there.
No, that's the
policymakers are enacting spending policies.
Yeah.
The spending of policymakers are way beyond and not in the interest of the people that they represent. They're
right.
Talking
they
about
money,
more taxes.
Yeah. Right, they spend money to win elections, and then want to tax us more to pay for their corruption. Now, this is one of the big lies out there. Okay, so let me explain this. Is every time a national debt question comes up, and Congress basically voted away the debt ceiling. There is no debt ceiling anymore. It's a myth. They just spend money. So spending money is now consent to raise the debt ceiling. That's how Nancy Pelosi did it, right? So the big lie is that we have to raise the debt ceiling, otherwise we can't meet our obligations. We'll default. Well, that's not true. The thing is, they make the obligations first, and then they raise the debt ceiling. That'd be like buying a luxury yacht and then saying to your credit card company, to meet my obligations, I have to have an increase on my, $5,000 credit card to, $850,000 to pay for my new yacht. What? That's insane. Well, but that's what the government's doing. They make the obligation and then they go to the Congress and say, well, now we've got to pay for it. We're obliged to do it. No, they're not. They can always cancel the obligation. They could always cancel the spending. They could revoke the spending. They could stop the spending on all these bills and say, we changed our mind. We can't spend, you know, $1.5 trillion on stimulus. We're going to make it to whatever money is spent right now, and we're going to send the rest back to the Treasury and lower and have that to pay off debt. You know, so there's a lot of things they can do, but they don't. But this lie, this is a pure lie, that government has to raise the debt ceiling or raise taxes to meet their obligations, they're coming at it backwards. No, you've got to lower your obligations to meet the debt ceiling. You've got to lower your obligations to meet the revenue. You know, I would this idea of a balanced budget amendment is insane. I want a bill, and we're going to work on this, that Congress cannot borrow money as long as there's any national debt or deficit. Can't borrow it. Sorry. You can only borrow it if you have, and of course, if you don't have a debt or deficit, there's no need to borrow money because you got enough revenue to cover your expenses. But Greg, what about an emergency? Okay, start a savings account. The government, that's what a treasury is for. The treasury is there to put money away for a rainy day. You got a nuclear war coming up, put money away for it. Okay? Don't raise taxes.
Well,
yeah.
Predictions mm-hmm. say that in 10 years, the interest on the debt will nearly triple from where it is today. And today is $900 million. And it will
billion.
Become the fastest
is it million or billion?
Part of the federal budget.
Is it million or billion?
Million.
That's it?
The interest on the debt, $900 million.
You sure it's that low?
Well, it's going to triple. So if it triples, you're talking about $2.7 billion.
The interest on the national debt exceeds the defense budget.
That's what it reads now.
Million. I bet you it's a billion. Hang on. Interest.
No, he's got millions. Peterson.
Let's see if the Peters are wrong. National debt exceeds defense budget. Hang on. TEF. Where's my producer? BDGET. Here we go.
But we only make sense because we know exactly what that does cost.
Here you go. Here you go. By 2025, this is nationalinterest.org, a blog. I'm going to post this too. Interest on the national debt, how it affects you. So not just the national debt, but the interest on the national debt. So what they were saying is that you have to grow your way out of it. As long as the economy was growing, we were making more money than we could take on more debt. Well, now that we're in a recession, I'll say it. Now that we're in a recession where the economy has negative growth, it's actually receding. That's what a recession is, where the economy is shrinking. We have less available money. Our national wealth is less than it was last year by like 1.9 whatever percent. So the fact that we have this huge national debt, you know, it'd be like if you lost your job. You know, so you've borrowed a ton of money. You've bought a new home. You've done all these things in anticipation of your new job. And what happens if the new job doesn't come through? What are you going to do? Oh, boy. You know, well, you sell the home or you don't buy the home or you change your agreements. But what the government would say is, well, we've already made the obligation to buy the new home and the luxury yacht. So we have to raise the credit limit to get the – and we have to print the money to do it. Well, that's what creates inflation. All right. So this is the article, which is not coming up fast enough for me. It says by 2025, the U.S. interest payments on the national debt will pass the defense budget. Okay, so they're almost there. With the gross national debt in excess of $22 trillion, well, of course, now it's $30 trillion, nearly 105% of the gross domestic product. And manage, I wish this article would come up. Why is it so slow? Yeah, well, all right, let me see if I can get PolitiFact. Let's see if they're going to tell us the truth. That would take a long time, too. It probably can't come up because I'm doing the show, and so my internet is probably slow. But, yeah, that's what, if it hasn't already, it's going to very soon. The national – interest on the national debt will be larger than the defense budget. See, interest on the national debt is empty money. It's wasted money. It doesn't accomplish anything. It should never have to be spent. So instead of spending money on things that should be spent, like infrastructure, the wall, stuff like that, they're taking all this money and spending it on worthless things because they borrowed so much before, because they couldn't wait, because they bought things they shouldn't have bought, because they gave out stimulus money and money to sit home and unemployment money they never should have given out. But they did. So now they've obligated us.
Well, the U.S. Treasury could do much of what you're paying the Federal Reserve to do.
Well, the Treasury could do everything the Federal Reserve does. That's the whole point of having a U.S. Treasury. So one of the fundamental changes we need is to get rid of the Federal Reserve and all monetary government policy, all monetary policy and all financial transactions should be done through the Treasury because they're accountable to the people. you know, through elections and people that are appointed to the Secretary of the Treasury, you know, is based on the president, you know, nominates and that confirms, you know, the Secretary of the Treasury. Okay. Well, that's far more important than the Federal Reserve. You know, the fact that they put the person on the Federal Reserve Board again, Jerome Powell, that said that inflation was transitory. Give me a break. We knew better than that. You know, you could put me on the Treasury Board. I'd do a better job than this idiot. Anyway.
And according to another source, that interest is $434 billion, $12,657,000, and the other three digits is running wild.
What's that?
So that $900 million must be per day. That's just ridiculous. Totally.
Yeah.
Totally ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Of course it is. Well, I mean, it's economic suicide. And this is what I've called economic treason and economic suicide, what we're doing right now. It's so easy to stop it. You literally cut the spending. You know, you just do a few things. You end the withholding tax, the nuclear tax revolt, okay? You get rid of the Federal Reserve. You have a constitutional amendment that Congress cannot borrow money. You know, I would say when there's a national debt, I would just say the Congress cannot borrow money. Let's make it, I mean, Jefferson wanted that. Let's make it very simple. Constitutional amendment, Congress cannot borrow money, which is going to force them to pay their obligations because they can't borrow it. You know, so if they want to spend anything, you know, and when all these bills come due, they're going to have to pay the bills, which is going to mean a massive budget cut. If they want to spend more money, they're going to have to reduce the debt. If they can't borrow money, the only way to spend more money is to take in, or they might try to raise taxes, but that'll cause a revolt too, especially if we get rid of the withholding tax. So just a few fundamental changes and we can turn everything around. Anyway, I'm going to give you a quick quote here. We've got about 4 minutes left. It says, talking about high gas prices. This is an article by M. Dowling in my new favorite site, Independent Sentinel, says, talking about gas prices, this is something Democrats have frequently called for, extremely expensive prices for oil and gas so they can force us into alternative energy. This is despite the fact that alternative energy cannot handle our needs yet. Even if it could, I might not necessarily want it. Democrats don't care. They know, and they don't care. Just look at the prices on the pumps and you'll know. Under Trump at one point, it was under $2 a gallon. You know, it's $1.85 around here. Reports say it went to $2.41 in Trump's last year. Now it's about double. So there you go. They simply don't care. They're raising prices to force us into solar and wind and electricity, which is generated by usually, you know, the very fuels that they don't want us to have. They just don't care. Bianchi?
That can sum it all up for the weekend.
Yeah. Well, I still got 3 minutes. But, yeah, let me give you the rest of the report here. It says, solid reporting by Zero Hedge, another one of my favorite sources. I'll have to look up this article. It says, we can expect over $6 a gallon of gas by August. So we're heading for my revolution at $7.50. Okay. J.P. Morgan's commodity strategist. In fact, I forgot to ask Derek about that. I'll ask him next week about the commodity, the futures market in oil. J.P. Morgan's commodity strategist Natasha Cavena warns that U.S. retail prices could surge another 37% by August to a $6.20 a gallon national average. We could easily see double-digit per gallon gas everywhere. That would be $10 a gallon or more. All stations will need to reprogram their pumps. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is going to cause a revolt. $7.50, that's my prediction. If it's going to be $6.20 by August, it'll probably be $7.50 by September. We're going to have a revolt before the midterms. Just my prediction.
Unfunded liabilities is $169
trillion. Mm-hmm. And the only way to pay that is to stop Congress from borrowing money.
No, plus you would have to rob every citizen in the country two or three times.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're not going to pay it. We're going to make it pay it. It's going to come out of a lot of things. Well, first of all, you have to end all entitlements. Social Security immediately has to be privatized. Medicare has to be, we need to go to a private health system that still manages, you know, care for seniors. I'm not sure how you do that, but that needs to be privatized. You know, you need a full voucher medical care. So in other words, all the taxes that are raised for Medicare would go to individuals in a health savings account, just as education would go to individuals in an education account, which can only be spent on educational things. You know, the full voucher healthcare could only be spent on healthcare things. But you'd have control of where you went, and you could control spending by simply, you know, spending your money competitively. And that would regulate the health market that way. That would regulate prices because they'd have price competition. But the first thing you do is stop Congress from borrowing money. And I think that's something we need to add to our list of absolutely critical bills. I'm going to write it probably this weekend. It'd be very a simple amendment to write. Congress shall not borrow money. You like that one? We got a minute. Pianki, what do you think?
Anything to control, anything to put more handcuffs on the federal government sounds good to me.
Okay. Well, do you think something that simple would work? You know, an amendment to the Constitution, Congress shall not borrow money?
Let's go with
it. Replacing the Congress shall lay and collect taxes and shall borrow. I think we got 35 seconds. Let me see if I can look this up real fast. Article 1, Section 8. If I can't do it now, we'll do it next week. Article Section 9. Where does it say Congress shall have the power to borrow money? The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes. I got 20 seconds. Taxes, duties, and imposts and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes and enforce and welfare of the United States to borrow money on the credit of the United States. So what I would do is basically is erase that clause. So that clause is going to go and replaced by Congress shall not borrow money. So to borrow money on the credit of the United States, we're going to take that one out. But that's how I'll do it. Okay. Pianki, talk to you next week. I'll have it posted before then. Sound good?
Be safe.
I'm going to take chances. Life isn't safe. I have no interest in being safe. I'm careful, but I'm not safe. Greg Fengels for Action Radio, blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Our latest website, writeyourlaws.com, WRATEYOURLAWS. And I'll be appearing tonight at the Medical Freedom Rally in Blue Wahoo Stadium. See you there or see you back Monday morning at 7 o'clock, our new time, 7 o'clock Central. See you then. Take chances.